Welcome, and thank you for holding. At this time, your lines are in listen-only mode. A public comment period is scheduled to take place after the opening remarks. If you're interested in commenting on today's topic, please press star one on your phone at any time to be placed in queue. There's a limited time set aside for public comment, so please keep your comments less than one minute. Stating your name and affiliation when prompted is optional. However, please provide at least an identifying alias. This will assist in administrating the session. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I'd like to turn the call over to Ms. Rajika Mahal. You may begin.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. I'm Rajika Mahal. I'm the Director of the Science and Technical, and I'm here today for the GRASP conference call meeting here today. Please note that this meeting is being recorded, and the recorded portion will be available to you at the PSU's website. At this point, I would like to make quick announcement here. There are last-minute schedule changes. Panel member Cal Bear Anderson and Tim Malloy. Cal Bear Anderson was joining us from Washington, D.C., and Tim Malloy was supposed to join us from Los Angeles. Unfortunately, both of them are unable to join us today, so they will not be on the call today. But any interested members of the public, whether in Washington, D.C. or Los Angeles or any other location, can join us via conference call and webinar. A gentle reminder for the members of the public here, please press star 1 if you would like to queue up for public comment period. GRASP members, please remember to press star 6 to mute your line while not talking. This just helps us reduce the noise and the background noise, so it just helps us work smoothly. And remember to unmute by star 6 when you're ready to speak. We also have webinar monitors. If you're experiencing any technical difficulties, please use the webinar chat tool and let us know. We'll try to address the issue as soon as we can. I will conduct the roll call, and we'll go over various locations. So please indicate if there are any members of the public and how many members of the public at your location. So starting with Berkeley, Kelly Moran, co-chair.
Yeah.
Kelly, can you please identify how many members of the public are there?
We have one.
Great. Thank you. Art Fong, co-chair.
Present.
Great. Anne Blake.
Present.
Becky Sutton.
Present.
Helen Holder.
She's not here yet.
Okay, thanks. Julia Quinn.
Present.
Meg Schwarzman.
Present.
Okay, so let's go over to Washington real quick. Ken Zarker?
Present. No public attendees.
Thank you, Ken. Ohio, let's go to John Rasik. John, are you on the line? Okay, looks like he's not on the call yet. Let's go to Maine, Ken Geiser.
Present, and there is no other public officials here, public members here.
Thank you, Ken. Moving on to Washington, D.C., Bill Carroll.
I'm here, and there are no members of the public.
Thank you, Bill. At this time, I will turn the meeting over to Miriam Barcelona Jr., the Acting Director for Department of Toxics of CSS Control. Miriam.
Thank you all. I wanted to just open today's meeting by starting with a thank you for your time and participating with the Green Ribbon Science Panel, and acknowledge the fact that because Debbie had been so involved with this group and with this effort from the very beginning, this is really my first entree into this effort. And I'm very excited for this opportunity to be more engaged with all of you and with this process. And so I thank you. I just also wanted to acknowledge that Debbie has left an incredibly important legacy. And that legacy was her commitment and her collaborative spirit that she invigorated the safer consumer products regulation, that it includes the assemblage of this amazing team that she's brought together, the incredibly talented group of folks with the knowledge and diversity that you all bring to the table, and I did enjoy getting to read a little bit about all of your backgrounds. And so I really am excited about what you all bring to the table and to this great effort that we have. And so thank you. But then also, she has really also helped assemble this incredibly talented team within DCSC. And we're all blessed and fortunate, really, to have such a great team with incredible leaders that include Dr. Meredith Williams, Carl, and Andre, and really all of you. And so I thank you, and I, again, look forward to getting to work more directly with you than I have had the opportunity to in the past. I also want to assure you that as we are in the transition period in the department, as you know, that I want to reiterate or to assure everybody that we are staying the course and that this continues to be a very important priority for the department, and that it's an exciting time for this program and for the department, and we are staying that course, that we have the full support and commitment of the agency and the administration, and that that the wisdom that you share with us will continue to guide and inform us as we move forward, that we got off to an incredible start with the regulations, that the announcement of the first draft priority product, that we have a solid foundation to start, that we look forward to the topics of today's conversation, the 3-year work plan, and as we kind of step into that next phase, we're very excited about the next phase of this project, and you know, we're listening as we go, and we appreciate what you guys are bringing to the table. And so thank you for the commitment you bring and the visionary work that you all have. So I just wanted to thank you and for your time. And I am looking at where you're all coming from and participating from. This is also speaks volumes to, again, this legacy that Daddy's was able to pull together and the work that Meredith and this team is continuing. This is no small effort, and it's a great import, not just to this state, but it's a model for the whole country. And so I thank you. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to you. Actually, I think I'm supposed to turn it over to Dr. Warren.
Thank you, Miriam. We really appreciate you making a little bit of time. I know your day is quite busy and you won't be able to participate for the whole discussion, but I know I, for one, am looking forward to having you more involved in the program and helping us navigate it as we move forward. So we appreciate you joining us. And I will say that the department is very fortunate to have Miriam at the helm as our acting director, just because she has been in state service for a while and knows how to get things done in state service, has an incredible political radar in terms of helping us make good decisions and, you know, set policy. So we are in very good hands, and as she said, everybody from the agency up to the governor's office is very much focused on the success of this program. So thank you, and again, thank you, panel members, for being here and for participating from our far-flung quarters. Hopefully our technology will help us make this feel as much of a cohesive meeting as possible. I'm looking forward to this day. I look forward to all of our interactions, just because the wealth of ideas that are generated certainly give us, we really don't want more on our to-do list, but as you'll hear throughout the day, you gave us a lot of food for thought at the last meeting. We're finding ways to act on that. We're excited. We think it really has deepened our approach to the program and to our product selections and some other and all our alternative analysis. So we'll be interested to hear your thoughts today. Today you'll get a little bit of an update of what's been going on with the announcement of the priority products. with how we're just beginning to integrate some of your thoughts about alternatives analysis into our guidance. And then we'll dig into the three-year work plan and how we're approaching selecting product categories for that work plan. As always, we're in very capable hands. County of Art, our fearless leaders, I think we all feel prepared. We'll have a great discussion today. And with no further ado, I'll say let's go.
Good morning, panel members. This is Art Song, and it's a pleasure for me to be back here today for another opportunity to work with you. I look forward to another exciting discussion. And as Dr. Williams mentioned, just in case you haven't gotten any feedback on the first in-person meeting that we had, panel provided the department with a lot of great ideas and insight, but more importantly, on us sharing what we know with the fact that we really pointed out issues and brought out questions that really lifted CTSC's thinking on the whole Safe Consumer Products program. So with that, I'm going to turn the mic over to my colleague, Kelly Moran, for her welcome remarks.
I'll just echo Art. I'll follow our instructions to, rather than repeat what someone else said, to say I agree, and I wholeheartedly agree with Art's comments. I do want to add one thing that I know some folks have been concerned about, the departure of the director, and that I really appreciate that the acting director was able to make the time to be part of this. I have heard many similar praises of our acting director as being a really capable manager for the department and having a lot of experience from government. And I also met briefly with Secretary Rodriguez, and he assured me the department will be staying the course, not just through this acting period, but with the next director. They're strongly committed to this program. And that reassured me greatly. I wasn't particularly nervous, but I was glad to hear it from his lips that he and the governor are committed to this program and that our work really matters to the department. So I want to thank everybody for making the effort to come the various distances and go through the logistical hassles of doing a Bagley team teleconference meeting, and looking forward to our discussion today. So back to Art.
Update for our colleagues in Sacramento, the organizers. Helen Holder from HP is here in Berkeley. She just came in. So today's agenda, today's webinar and conference call will include an update on the Safe Consumer Products Program and a panel discussion on approaches to identify product categories for the three-year priority product work plan. For the panel members, priority product work plan background document with product category approach discussion questions was distributed to you for review in preparation of this discussion today. The document that I'm referring to were also posted on the DTSC Green Ribbon Science Panel website. So for the public, if you have not seen that, and you need to it's going to help you follow along with today's discussion, you can go to the website and get that. At this time, I'm going to turn over the meeting to DTSC Deputy Director, Dr. Meredith Williams, for a program update.
So, the first thing we'll do is just give you a snapshot of where we are and what's been happening. I did want to mention, and Kelly's going to say a few words about this, we were asked to give a program update to the ESGM committee of the assembly, and that went quite well. It was very, very well received. We had great representation from the NGO community, from industry representation, including impacted parties to the products we selected, as well as and I really did want to make a public thank you for your testimony. It was very well received. You represented this panel very, very well, and I know it took a lot of preparation. I know that you and Art did a lot of work to think about what your key messages were to the committee and how you could support us. Use your hearing as an opportunity to support us. I will say that the take-home from the committee was, how can we help you? And so that's a good indicator that, they are paying attention and they are supportive. Obviously, resources will be an issue where we'll need support sooner or later. We're starting small and trying to, you know, learn and get our processes in place and then determine what resources we need to really maintain and sustain the program to have the biggest impact as we move forward. And so we invited them to ask us back again after we have a little more ground behind us and we're a little further down the road. So we do expect to have other opportunities to testify before them and to be more explicit about what support we're asking for. Thanks.
So, as Meredith said, this is Kelly, the Assembly's Environmental Safety and Toxic Materials Committee had invited me and Art, who actually was not available to participate in person, to be part of this hearing because they really wanted to hear what was going on with the science panel, and they had a series of formal questions for me to answer, and so I worked with Art to prepare the responses. And I just wanted to share with you a few key lessons that I took home from this. The first is that the legislature thinks it's very important that we're providing expert advice to DPSC. Their legislature is very interested in independent oversight to ensure the scientific integrity of the program. And so I heard about that. We had a little bit of discussion about science versus policy decisions, and that's something that is just a reminder for us. We all know that as a science advisory panel, we're advising on science. The department does make policy calls that are based on more than science. And so we clarified that a little bit with the committee to help clarify our role, which is advisory. The final thing I heard was strong, as Mara said, strong continued support for the program from both sides of the aisle. So both the vice chair and the chair specifically commented that they thought this program was going well and they were continuing support of it. At the end of the hearing, I promised Chair Alejo, he thanked us, and I promised that I would pass along his thanks for your volunteer service to you. He and the committee really appreciate that we're helping California establish the Safer Consumer Products Program. The chair was glad to know that there's such great expertise available to DPSC, and they were very impressed with your resumes and list of skills. And they're also really glad to know that DPSC is really using the expertise of this panel. So he expressed his appreciation for the panel's work in helping provide a solid scientific foundation for this program. So thank you from Chair Alejo to all of you. So back.
Thank you.
And so I think we're back over to Meredith or Carl.
Carl is going to give us an actual presentation on where we are with the program. So,
I'm not sure if it's live here.
Okay.
So,
Carl Palmer.
Okay, so.
So, I'm going to focus on a few things today, which is really an update from our last meeting, the activities on our alternative analysis guidance development, a little bit about the information technology tools we're developing, and then talk about our priority product selection workshops and where we are with that process. First, reporting back, after our meeting in April, we collected 25 and 30 specific suggestions, action items, follow-ups for our AA team to consider in developing guidance. And so we're actively incorporating those into our process of developing the guidance right now. And we also are churning on some of the things that were brought up that we feel we probably will want to come back to you at our October meeting and have some further discussion on. And I queued up a few of those, such as how we deal with data quality and data gaps, how we establish criteria, or explain to folks the criteria the department will use in evaluating alternatives analyses, and also how we use and develop rubrics, which is a team thought was a good idea in terms of helping people get through this process. Because a big part of what we're going to be doing is dealing with the challenge of how we communicate the transition from the requirements and the regulations to practice. And so those tools are going to be very important to everyone who's trying to actually conduct an alternative analysis. Some of the things we discussed at the last meeting were resonated, I think, with the team in terms of the discussion we had on the use of conceptual models. And some of the things I think we sort of took for granted, but I think it was insightful that we saw that sometimes how you communicate those, whether visually or in language, is important to those people who are going to be working through the process. So that was extremely helpful. And we'll be working with the chairs before the next meeting to tee up some of these success items as well. So we're moving along on that. I also wanted to highlight that we are happy to announce that we've received preliminary indication from US EPA that we're receiving a pollution prevention grant for the next 3 years, which will, it's not a huge amount of money, it's a little over $100,000, but we propose to EPA that looking at our work plan for developing the alternatives analysis guidance, that there were certain components of that where we could use funding to hire consultants to bring in people to look at everything from different tools for hazard screening assessment and how we deal with some of these key issues, which will give us greater latitude to work through this process and develop good tools and products. So we're excited about that. We're in the process of refining that. We didn't get everything we wanted, of course, in our grant proposal, but we'll be working with Region 9 to modify that in the near term. So we're very excited about that as well. So, of course, can we go to the next slide? We wanted to highlight that we're doing a lot of work that people aren't seeing yet, particularly on the development of information technology tools. Again, part of our challenge is how are we going to communicate with people? One thing I'll note is that we're working very actively on many fronts on our webpage, both design, function, organization, how people can not only find documents, but understand the process, and we're going to be working on that. But I also wanted to highlight that we're developing a tool we're calling CalSafer, and that tool is really designed to be a portal through the web for all stakeholders to provide the department with information and to receive information from us and to sort information that's publicly available. So in our first phase of development, we're focusing on comments that we will be sort of putting for our three-year work plan. And that's going to come online in July, and there will be an opportunity for people to go online, give us a comment, submit it, register with us, and as well as see other comments that are provided to the department. We'll then, in October, be expanding that function for all of the comments that we receive through the different processes, both for the development of the work plan, as we start looking at getting petitions, if someone wants to submit a petition to the department to either have identical, a product, a combination, look at lists, they can do that through the web, provide all the documentation through the web, have all three publicly available. And then ultimately, it will also be the tool we use as we enter the rulemaking process formally, so that people can see all of the comments that are provided to the department, sort through those, and get documents from us as well. So, and then further on, will be as we enter the alternative analysis process, people will be able to register with us, notify us, give us information, we'll be able to do the same. So, we don't have an example of that yet. I think for Cynthia, she's talking about the process. You'll see a graphic of a demo slide, but are excited about it. Ultimately, even when we do regulatory responses, we'll be able to share that publicly with all the documentation that we have and that we consider as we move through that process, and that will be a ways out. But we're putting a lot of effort into this, and it's going to be important to our effects. So, a little bit about where we are in selecting our first round of priority products. We just finished our last three workshops that we held publicly, both in Sacramento, Oakland, and Los Angeles, inviting folks to give us comments about our proposed priority products, and as well to have a dialogue on moving forward on that process. We had about a little over 180 participants, more in Sacramento than the other two locations, but pretty good participation. It was predominantly from, you know, industry, manufacturers, contractors, people who were going to be regulated in some manner potentially. And we got a lot for those sectors that were directly affected by the priority products of dialogue. We didn't get a lot of input from advocacy groups, NGOs, environmental or health, although some from labor and some participation interests, which is good. Not as much as it certainly is. Anyone else? Next slide.
I will say we're really happy that Mike was able to join one of the workshops and get to see that and plot it with me.
Yes. Thank you, Mike. So we're very happy about the process that we went through because it did meet our primary objective, which was to listen, hear what various stakeholders' perspectives on the priority parts we were proposing, talk about the process, learn their the nuances of each of these channels and sectors that are important to our consideration for selecting the product and how we'll work through the process. It was also a great opportunity for us to, I think, educate some of those stakeholders because, as you well know, the regulations themselves are broad and deep and complex. And some of the folks were just coming into the process for the first time. So it gave us an opportunity throughout the supply chain, both from the chemical manufacturers, the product manufacturers, the distributors, in some cases contractors who use these products, to understand how this process is going to work both in time, purpose, and process. That was helpful. We did have some learnings. I'll highlight a few of them that we've already made some decisions on. One good example is that when we, in our regulatory concept, said this is what a spray polyurethane foam system looks like, we had two main types of systems. We had, or three actually. One was roofing systems, one was insulation, and one was for cracks and sealants. In our roofing system perspective, we included coatings on roofs. Well, what we found out in this process is that really those are two different types of products. There's the product that actually creates the foam, the spray foam for roofing systems, and then they apply a different product on the top of that, and there's a variety of those products. So our perspective changed a little. We learned something, and we decided that that was really needs to be refined. And so we're really focusing on the spray foam process itself. And what that did functionally was take some of the chemicals that are found in those coatings off the table and also better define what we were talking about and who we were talking to, who's regulated the next one. That was an example of some of the things we learned. And we received a lot of input, both formal and informal, and we were considering that for each of the three products that we put out there. And so we will potentially be making additional changes that will then be identified and shared with everyone as we move towards rulemaking. And we put together all of the information in the studies relied on, the supporting documents, our commission statement of reasons, and ultimately the regulations text, which will define what those comments are. I also wanted to note that we received a lot of feedback and some learnings, I think, in terms of the power of our information and how it's used by various folks or not. And so, for example, the profile, particularly in the straight polyurethane foam industry, was pointed out that some of their competitors were using some of the materials we put out to say their product is better than this product. And things that we weren't really attempting to say or weren't saying, but weren't necessarily clear. So we did put in each of the product profiles a disclaimer, which tried to frame what those documents were. They were a snapshot in time of our perspective, and that's evolving as we move forward and we'll be fine. So I think on the big picture, it was helpful to us to see the importance of how we say things, how we package things, and not to necessarily make assumptions that people know in depth the minutiae of the regulations. That was very helpful. So all of this is moving towards this fall removal. We'll be putting together regulations packages for each of the three priority products moving forward. So it was a great success on our office session. Next question. That's it for me.
Yes.
So I think Portentia is going to talk now about the fourth plan
statement.
Can you introduce yourself? Yes, so Portentia Muniz is a senior engineer in our consumer products team. She's heading up a team of folks who are looking at developing our three-year priority products work plan. And that's why we're here today predominantly. So.
Good morning, everyone. I'll give a really quick overview of the three-year priority products work plan because it'll be one of the discussions that we'll be talking about later on this morning. And just to remind everyone, it's advised of the way the regs are written, it requires the department to, that within 1 year after the regs are adopted, which was last year, 2013, October 1st, that within 1 year the department make available and submit for public review the priority product work plan. And then every 3 years that we prepare a new work plan, and if you look at the schedule, it almost requires that every 2 years the department will be submitting a work plan for public review and recommending product categories for evaluation in those 6 years. The work plan must identify and describe the product categories that DTSC will be evaluating those during those 3 years, and it must explain the decisions to select identified product categories for evaluation. So if you look at the cycle, it gives you the opportunity to evaluate those product categories every 2 years, and some that are captured can then be reevaluated the following 2 years or the next 3 year cycle. And the way the work plan, the requirements in the regs, it doesn't change how the law works too much. It's important to note that the regulations don't change existing law. In other words, if DTSC is already required to take a particular action through legislative mandates, through executive order, we must continue to do so. And so the regulations accommodate that. And then it also has a provision where if a petition is submitted to DTSC and is granted, then it allows us to roll that petition into that work, the current work plan, and then consider it for evaluation, whether it's to add a chemical, remove a chemical, et cetera, or a product chemical or product chemical combination. Next slide. There's a requirement that the key prioritization factors for evaluating those product chemical combinations be considered, and it's similar to what's in the same factors that were taken into account when the current priority products that are going for review, that we evaluate that same criteria, that the products must have the potential to expose people or the environment to one or more of the candidate chemicals. And the other one is that there has to be a potential exposure to either cause a significant impact or a widespread impact, or it could be both. Next slide, please. Currently, we estimate that we will finish after we have met, convened this. It's one of the reasons that it was important that we meet and discuss. We'll be using your input and looking at the product category and then revising it and then having a draft line, draft for review in July of this year. There will be a 30-day comment period. We currently have two workshops scheduled, one here in Sacramento on August 13th, and the other one in Cyprus on August the 14th, with the public comment period closing on the 15th. And this is a sample of what is to come. This is not, it's still in development. this will not be, this is not quite the Cal Stager system entirely, but eventually once the work plan is made public, you will have, if you logged on, this is what you would see, and from right here you could click on the title of the document, be able to review the document online, and then click on a submit a comment and provide the comments to the department. And so it should be up and running by the 15th or as soon as the work plan is released. And we encourage you to review it and provide your comments through the system, not only so that we can get your comments, but also get feedback on the system, on the usability of the system, so that we can make refinements for the final release of the system in October.
Thank you very much for that update, Hortensia, and also call Rachel. Thank you very much. The next up on agenda item number three is...
Can you ask a question?
Yes.
Yeah, for Hortensia. I just wasn't inside to interrupt us. my ears perked up when Hortensia specifically, I just want to clarify, it sounds like you're interested in receiving the Green Ribbon Science Panel members on the draft work plan when that comes out in July, or was that just sort of in general just a hope for a bunch of public comments?
In general for a bunch of public comments, also from the Green Ribbon Science Panel, of course. You'd like to hear, get as much input as we possibly can. So it's both from the Green Ribbon Science Panel members and also from the public.
That's great.
We don't have a formal meeting scheduled where the panel would be present and inclusive for the time. So, individual panel member comments.
Can I just make a general comment about comments, which is that in our priority products workshops, we're requesting that folks give us comments by the end of June. That's an informal process. We're not in the EPA rulemaking process. It's not a formal comment process. We will still consider input after June 30th. The same will be true for the work plan because it's not a formal comment period. We just are trying to get people to give us input as early as possible and a tool that will help make that easier, so that we, particularly for the work plan where we do have a deadline of getting that thing done by October. So hopefully this will help.
Actually, that's an excellent segue because, again, actually, this is the time opportunity for panel members to ask clarifying questions of Carl and Hortensia and what they presented to us today. So we're going to use the method that we used last time for our colleagues in Berkeley. If you have a question, please use the name hand method for raising your hand. And for people, members who are using the webinar tool, please use the messaging. Is it a network?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or you're ready to take messages, right?
Yes.
Okay. Please use the messaging to indicate that you would like to ask a question. And for those who are not able to use the webinar tool, Kelly and I will just go around the various locations to ask if, in fact, you would like to make a comment. So let's start with our panel members here in Berkeley. And again, please use the name hand method, and please identify yourself so people on the phone know who's making the comment. And I have Julia to start.
This is Julia Clegg, and I have two questions. One has to do with comments. In the commentary of the priorities profile, will you be changing those based on your comments, the written version of those? I'm trying to get clear what the process is, because we commented at the formal panel, but then, you know, after you look at it a while, you have individual comments, and so are those, when we submit comments, are those as individuals? Are we submitting those as individuals and not on behalf of the Green Ribbon Science Panel? So we should make that distinction.
Yes. You would be commenting as an individual.
Right. Okay.
Your earlier part of your question is, we're considering all the comments, and we may revise, the prior product profile or the definition of the product or scope or whatever.
Right.
And that will be reflected in what we put together for the notice for the rulemaking.
Okay.
And then, and even then, once we go to formal notice, there'll be another formal comment period.
Okay.
Individuals are welcome to also formally respond to. We are not required, and we may not respond directly to.
Right. Okay. Then my second question is a part of something you said in terms of what you learned at the workshop, and it had to do with the coatings versus a roofing versus the foam product. And you said that if the coatings, it seems, they have the same isocyanate, the diisocyanate in them.
What we found specifically was that there's a number of different types of coatings that are used on roofing systems.
Uh-huh.
Everything from various polymers, the things that do contain isocyanates, are formed from two actual gravel, which is used because the primary purpose of the coating is a UV protection, and it depends by region, cost, and then we weren't making a judgment about the merit of those chemicals or coatings in terms of should they be considered. We were looking at the definition of the product more so that we refine that. So we weren't saying that there's not necessarily any problem with coating. We're saying our focus is really on the foam.
Right. It just brings up one of those situations where we're, trying to protect against asthma or whatever from the foam. But if in some situations you're using a coating that has the same chemicals, it's just kind of leads to awareness that to be complete, maybe, that would be something we would consider as some future product category. Same with the methylene chloride and, the N-methyl pyrrolidone, which could be a substitute. So I guess for me it's important to keep track of those situations where you have another exposure that could cause an endpoint that, like that, you say that we think we've dealt with already in terms of the phone. So I can see you're wanting to separate it because it would need to be separated, but it's also something that we should keep track of because we would have an incomplete position as far as that's concerned. If they're using a coating that has the same diode.
Next up, I have Blake.
Thank you, Art. This is Anne Blake following on Julia's comment. So you narrowed the scope down to that particular priority product?
Yes.
And sort of following on Julia's question about those chemicals being present in those coatings, that same sort of foam use in other applications or non-building applications, is that something that you would, I'm sort of struggling with how we would capture that, other uses where there are other coatings. For example, we happen to know that utilities use the same kind of spray polyurethane foam just to initially set utility poles. Maybe just exposure, and some of the alternatives that we'd find for building products for which it goes to priority products might also work for that. How do you, issues like that, I can see defining the priority products for, for, so that we could, get our hands around a particular subset of uses. But I think following on Julia's thought, we need to figure out how to track other potential uses that could be affected if we find alternatives for the subset of uses just defined.
Good point. I think broadly we are keeping track of the input we got, and I think there are, the work plan, for example, might be an area where we might look at other isocyanate products.
Mm-hmm.
Because we did find out that there are apparently a lot of other coating products or coverings and things that use similar chemistries. So those might be things we would consider. But the regulation will need to be very specific in terms of what specific product and chemical we capture and for what use. And then, but we will consider in future rounds other applications might be similar.
Mary?
And this is Beth Williams, and I would say that as we go further along, that sort of the future process will probably play a big role in that, somebody who is well aware that an application is very similar chemistry, very similar exposure, but maybe is a different product, might be something
you can address. This is Meg Schwartz, and I had one other question, which is something that I remember hearing from the early conversations about the regulatory requirements for the first that a priority product seems different slightly from the regulatory requirements for the subsequent priority product and the work plan. And so I think I have a small sense of what that difference is, but I think it might be helpful if you would just re-articulate that for the panel.
Sure. There's really two differences from the first round and subsequent rounds. One being that we restricted to the first round no more than five products. We chose three. We did that because on the merit of those products and because we want to be deliberate, wise, prudent, successful. The other big issue is that the first round were restricted to chemicals which were found on both the exposure, what we call the, you know, the hazard trait list and the exposure list. That narrowed that menu down to about 150 chemicals per down from 1,100. Subsequent rounds do not have that restriction, so any chemical found on any of the 23 lists now available for us.
Okay, and you have to hit both.
Correct. It could be on one or the other. Let's just go on both. So the menu for subsequent rounds is on the chemical side is much larger.
Rotating to the Sacramento office, Mike. Do you have a comment? Question?
We're duly on the mute here. I do. Thank you. This is Mike Caragiola with SC Johnson. I just kind of want to comment on Julia and Ann's comments. Though first I want to say I want to commend DTSC on the priority product workshops themselves. The professionalism and preparation that they exhibited was just amazing. They were extremely well done and informative to those who attended. Regarding chemicals that are found within the sealants or other priority products as we go, and do we look at spreading that further and keeping that in mind, I would suggest instead of saying, okay, we're going to keep, say, the sealant rather than other components, that instead of going and saying we're going to pick other priority products around that same category, that same chemical, and just keep expanding around it, you're going to waste the agency's time in a way, because what we hope to see, at least in my mind, is that industry takes it very seriously, and that what happens is we take it out of one type of product, and that technology expands to other products. So those isocyanates not only don't appear anywhere in the DIY product, but they don't appear in the associated products with it. And so give it time to make that particular chemical weed its way out of products and keep hitting some other items. We can always go back, you know, say in the next three-year plan, but don't keep hitting the same item now because we're going to dilute the efforts with very low resources. I think what we should see through industry is that, okay, this particular player has been designated as bad, and we don't want it anywhere. So it should act as a ripple effect out to remove that chemical.
Thank you very much, Mike. Corey, are there any more comments on the webinar tool that you can do?
Art, this is Don Gerstig. Can you hear me?
Yes, Don. Please go ahead.
Okay, no, I didn't have a comment. It's just during the roll call, I was on as the public telephone number. I hadn't received the panel-only telephone number. Cal Larry Anderson forwarded that to me. So I was present. I've been present for the whole meeting, but this was my first opportunity to get in and say hello to everybody. So,
excellent. We're glad that you're on.
So I'm on.
Okay. Not seeing any more comments on the webinar tool, let's go to Maine and see if Ken Geiser has any comments or questions. Ken?
Thank you, Art. I do not. I congratulate the staff for the proposed three-year plan that's put forward, but I do not have any clarifying questions. Thank you.
Great. I'm not seeing any more hands for comments. We're going to switch now to agenda item number 4, public comments, and I'm turning the mic over to my co-chair, Charlie Horner.
Thank you. So just as a reminder, we're a little behind on our time, but we are, what's coming up today is a brief public comment period. We'll introduce and have a short initial part of our discussion. We're intending to have a break in the 10:30-ish time frame for just about 10 minutes. And then we'll resume, and we're going to hope to wrap our discussion up by 12:15 and be out of our meeting by 12:30, and all of those times are Pacific. For those of you who are on Pacific time, I'm sure you can do the math. So so with that, we're moving to the public comment period. And this is an unusual type of public comment period in public processes, so I just want to make sure before we do this that folks understand the purpose of the public comment. The, if you're wanting to say something today, your comments will be on to the science panel itself, not to DTSC. And the focus of your comments should be on the items that are on today's agenda, which were the program updates that you just heard, and the discussion topics, which are on the approaches to selecting the priority products, which is what the panel will be discussing the rest of this time. So, and just to reemphasize, general comments to DTSC are not appropriate, but comments can be made to DTS3C through its website using the feedback button. And so that if you go to the Safer Consumer Products site, there is a place to provide that kind of feedback, and you also heard in the staff updates information about the upcoming workshop. So there will be plenty of opportunities to comment to DTSC, but this is your chance to comment to the science panel. Although the operator said there will be a one-minute limit, I think we just can't ask people to finish their comments in less than 2 minutes. So we'll be aiming for very brief comments from the public. But, of course, you can always comment in other ways. I do want to remind people that this is a working meeting for the panel. So the public can't ask questions during the discussion of agenda topics. So this is the real goal of this meeting, is for the panelists to be advising DTSC. Before I turn this over to the operator, I want to let people know that we'll start the public comment period with those on the conference line, and then we'll move on to the different locations. When we surveyed the locations previously, there was only one member of the public, and that was here at Berkeley. So I would like to check again if you're at a location and now have one or more members of the public when you did not before, could you please so signal now?
Kelly, this is Radhika from Sacramento. We do have one member of the public here.
Okay. So we now have one in Sacramento and one in Berkeley. Anywhere else? All right. So we have very limited attendance. So now I'll turn it over to the operator to see if there are comments. I will go back to the operator's end in case someone hadn't pressed *1 before this opportunity. To wrap up with any teleconference comments before we move on. So, operator, are you ready to take over?
Thank you. If you have a question or comment, please press *1 and record your name. Our first comment comes from Ms. Dawn Tepke. You have an open line.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Pleased to speak with you again. Some of you for the first time, but many of you a number of times over the past number of years. So I am representing the Manufacturers and Technology Association this morning, and as you know, also one of the co-chairs of the Green Chemistry Alliance, with just a couple of comments regarding kind of the background paper approaches that were provided to the panel for consideration. One of the things, a couple of points are to approach number 3 on page 3, around chemical prioritization. Just note concerns of the industry and really focusing in on chemical prioritization as kind of a standalone outside of prioritizing the chemical product combination. Really, as you know, the whole point of the green chemistry effort that kind of brought this to fruition was getting away from a chemical du jour kind of approach. So that is a concern in terms of the conversation, the deliberation, and how that will feed into your comments and suggestions. Also, with regards to approach number 4, evidence of exposure, not entirely clear how that would lead to prioritizing a product. From our perspective, just because a chemical shows up in biomonitoring, dust studies, environmental monitoring, it doesn't seem to provide a clear and direct link to a very specific product, in that that chemical could present itself in a number of different products. So trying to prioritize purely around exposure in those types of studies could be difficult and could be problematic making that link.
Additionally, in number five, relative to workers with a sensitive subpopulation, we would just note that the regulations and the enacting statutes really are very clear on avoiding regulatory duplication and superseding of regulatory authorities. And in this regard, just would note that Cal OSHA, as well as federal, has oversight and jurisdiction relative to workers, so just to be mindful of that. And then finally, just overall, I'm just urging the panel, as you contemplate providing feedback to the department, just to be mindful of the impacts of these priority product listings, whether it's individual products, product chemical combinations, or product categories, and the impact that will have in the market relative to the first three that we're seeing and kind of reviewing with DTSC now. There have been market impacts associated with that, and the concern of industry is pretty significant that the information in, you know, associated with these listings, whether it's an individual product chemical combination or category, that be right, and we've really been urging that there be discussions with those industries ahead of listing those to make sure that the information put out is correct and isn't going to negatively impact products that wouldn't otherwise be a problem without further detail that these individual companies and product manufacturers may have. So with that, I appreciate the opportunity to comment and look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. You were just hearing me say it. You've gone well over your 2 minutes. So for any future speakers, you'll hear that little tone that you heard a minute ago, the beep sound. That when you hear that sound, your time is up and wrap up. Thank you. So for the operator, how many more how many more requests do we have to speak from the phone?
We have one more.
Oh, okay. Please.
Our next question comes from Randy Fishback. You have an open mind.
Thank you, operator, and thank you, Green River Science Panel and DTSC. I'm Randy Fishback with the Dow Chemical Company. I just want to express a little bit of concern with something I just heard from a Green River Science panelist. I think it was Mike a few minutes ago, who said that the DTSC should be cautious not to dilute its effort by picking further priority products, chemical product combinations that are similar or have the same chemical in them. And I don't want to misquote Mike, but it was something he said something along the lines of the removal of that chemical work its way through the marketplace so that you can go tackle other things. And the phrase I'm concerned about is the removal of that chemical from the marketplace and from similar products, because this presumes an answer or a conclusion that the chemical will be banned or will be removed. I think the DTSC has done some similar things. Carl commented earlier about market reaction, that some people in the market were using the very proposal of some of these priority products as a way to suggest that they're going to be banned and that people need to move on to other things, using other things and other alternatives. And then the DTSC on its website, when it first announced the priority product or proposed priority products, said to avoid exposure, while it's going through the process, avoid exposure of these products. And I'm a little concerned, and I know industry is in general, that everybody's presuming that at the end of the pipeline, at the end of the process, this all results in a ban, and we've all identified other alternatives. And because there are other options available to DTSC, like labeling, like product restrictions, like further research, I would caution the Green River Science Panel not to presume that things are just going to be banned because they're named. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there, it's a perfect timing. I want to thank both of the commenters for their thoughtful comments. Operator, are there additional commenters?
There are no other comments. Thank you.
All right. So I'll check here in Berkeley. Do you wish to comment?
Yes.
Can you come up to the table, please, and introduce yourself?
Good morning, Dina Singla with Natural Resources Defense Council. I had a couple comments. I wanted to say that supporting broader product categories would be a good approach, you know, recognizing that there is the need for some specificity, but also recognizing that similar to the chemical in closely related products will likely present similar exposure and life cycle concerns. And I'd also like to comment on thinking about classes of chemicals rather than single chemicals. And this sort of follows on U.S. EPA's approach to assessment of some of their top priority chemicals, where they do recognize that structurally similar chemicals, just like similar hazard traits, can be evaluated together as a class rather than one by one. And in terms of the various approaches laid out to thinking about the work plan priority products, I think that they're all sound and present different lines of evidence and for prioritizing, and that if there is some overlap, that's not necessarily a bad thing, because that overlap could also be used to further prioritize within the different approaches. And some things might come out as from each approach, and that would also be a good prioritization factor. And once you think about using a more integrated approach where you, for example, choose a hazard endpoint like neurodevelopmental toxicity that affects vulnerable subpopulation, children in this case, and then look at household deaths as an exposure pathway to which children are more vulnerable. So then you can narrow in on chemicals of concern in deaths that cause neurodevelopmental toxicity and try to take a look at those products as a way to prioritize. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, in Sacramento, are there any commenters?
No.
All right, so back to the operator for a last check to see if anyone else has indicated a desire to comment.
No other comments, thank you.
All right, thank all of you for your brevity and clarity in your comments. It's very helpful to us. Now I have to find where I am on the notes. So we're now ready to move to the next agenda item. And this is the panel discussion of the approaches to the product category identification for your product work plan. And as has already been amply mentioned, we did receive a memo that laid out some approaches the department's been considering and perhaps using for us to react to and think about. And that memo, of course, reacted to some of the input that we had previously provided at our last meeting. So we are being asked here to advise DTSD whether or not the proposed approaches provide the breadth of perspectives that we previously recommended, and specifically are they doing the kinds of things that we were recommending, and about the merits and potential challenges associated with these approaches, and are there other approaches? These are the questions that are in front of us. Art's going to be chairing the discussion of the first three questions, and then I'll be picking up and chairing the last two, and we'll have that break where we come to the break and the conversation's 10:30-ish. So before we go to the discussion, I do want to do two check-ins. One is that if you're not talking and you're, particularly if you're on a phone, it's helpful for the audio quality if you press *6 and mute yourself, and then don't forget to press *6 again when you want to talk. We're hearing some fairly heavy breathing on occasion, and I think that means somebody's just close to their mic. My headset is too. So I encourage the *6 use, because that'll help the whole conversation, and you don't want to hear yourself on the recording. But that also means we'll have to breathe twice if we don't hear you talking and we're calling on you, so that you have time to press *6 again. And then the other check-in is just whether there are any clarifying or procedural questions at this time from the panelists at any of the locations. Hearing none, I'll turn it over to Art. And we'll get to the fun part.
Thank you, Kelly.
Oh, I'm sorry, Julia.
I think on one of the approaches, you made note of the fact that you're thinking of one ecological
Number one. The department is strongly considering identification of at least one ecological pinpoint product category. And I just wanted to, I mean, a number of the hazard traits have ecological implications when this is centered by accumulation. So when you say that, when you pull it out like that, do you mean independent of toxicity? Or I didn't quite understand why that was.
I think part of it is that philosophically we're trying to really test the breadth of the regulations, and this is a unique set of regulations in terms of that breadth to be able to look at ecological impact, biota, consistent.
So it wouldn't necessarily be associated with a fault.
It may not, yeah. What we're trying to say is the human health and then
everything else. Right, 100%. Okay. I just want to clarify that.
Good. Thank you very much, Julia. Now we're going to continue with the panel discussion on approaches to product category identification for the 3-year priority product work plan. Specifically, the Green Ribbon Science panel is asked to respond to the following topics and questions. And the first question is, are there fundamental concerns about any of the approaches outlined above? Are there any anticipated challenges? And again, the mechanism for making a comment or intervention at the physical location is to use the name hand, to raise your hand, and then we will rotate to the webinar too and then to the various locations. I have Anne, Becky, Meg, Julia, so let's start with Anne Blake. Anne?
Thanks, Art. Anne Blake again, and I was somewhat anticipated by my colleague from NRDC, so thank you for those comments. One proposal that I wanted to make, I have no concerns with any of these approaches, but I would very strongly recommend that you use some kind of decision maker if you knew I was going to take that decision. But use an integrated approach so that you hit multiple points when you're making these decisions about the next step of priority products. So, for example, looking at exposure and exposure impact at more than one stage of the life cycle, for example, so potentially at worker exposure use in manufacturing, worker exposure in manufacturing and use phase of either ecotox or human health exposure and end-of-life exposure concerns, something like that. And also to echo my NRDC colleagues talking about classes of chemicals, but also classes of use, so functional use, so I think that gets a little bit to the question we were talking about earlier in diisocyanates and polyurethane foam. You could have that broadly as a use, without necessarily narrowing down to building use or use in, you know, various other ways. So another way of classifying potential impact. And then I very much appreciate the route of exposure approach. The endpoint approach, the health endpoint approach. So a combination of if you get a chemical and or product combination that gets multiple endpoints or you prioritize a certain endpoint, we can talk about potential ways of doing that, but that's, again, strongly recommend doing an integrated approach where you get multiple endpoints and or multiple routes of exposure at different types of life cycles. And I'll leave it at that. I'll hand it out to the rest of my colleagues.
And thank you. I have Becky next.
I just wanted to clarify whether wildlife might be considered sensitive subpopulation. I think that was called out in the letter here. Or documents, whether it's consumer product documents, and it's not specifically called out.
This is Carl. I don't believe, I think the regulations do two things. One, they, I think, highlight endangered species, but it also gives us latitude to make a determination to the department about what is a sensitive subpopulation. Because the
Carl, this is Radhika. Can I interject real quick?
Sure.
We could not hear what the previous speaker said at all. If possible, if he wants, you know, if they can repeat it, if he wants.
Thank you.
Hey, this is Becky. I just wanted to see whether wildlife might be part of the sensitive subpopulation.
Did you hear that?
Yes. Thank you.
And again, this is Carl, and my response was that I think that the regulations specifically identify endangered species, but also give us some latitude to identify other endpoints, if you will. So.
Thank you very much, Carla, and thanks for the question, Becky. I have Meg up next.
Thanks very much, Meg Schwartzman. I'm sort of cheered by the presentation about how you intend to use these screening approaches. I think their greatest strength is in their overlap. So as long as you're not trying to choose among these, I think that you've actually laid out a very good range of ways to approach identifying priority products. My one note of caution is around the route of exposure approach, which I think the sense of my caution that I wanted to give is that as long as that's empirically based, it's okay. But I think when we tend to look just without necessarily relying completely on evidence at what we think might be the most worrisome route of exposure, we end up chasing things that seem flashy to us but may not be the most significant either point in a life cycle of a product or chemical or route of exposure or most exposed population. So we tend to go quickly to consumer products, to things that are applied directly to skin, that sort of thing that seems like the highest likelihood of exposure just because it seems like it. But I think often that leads us away from some of the other higher risk exposure that may be sort of invisible. And so I think it's okay to keep it in here because it's an interesting hypothesis generating approach. So you may say, I wonder if there are really high routes of exposure for aerosolized substances or for substances applied directly to skin. And as a hypothesis generating approach, I think it's a good one. But then you need to look to biomonitoring data or environmental monitoring data. There needs to be another kind of axis where empirical data comes in to inform that decision, or I worry about it leading to sort of focusing on particularly consumer exposures or that may not actually be as significant as some of the things that we need to hit in some of these first passes of finding more information about. So as long as it's one way of generating ideas that is then sort of empirically supported through other evidence, I think it's fine to leave it on here. I don't mean to say that you should eliminate it. It's an interesting way to generate hypotheses. But I wouldn't sort of rely on that one in particular on its own.
Thank you, Mary. I have Julia, Ken Geiser, and Helen next. Julia?
I have a personal question about how we identify, is there a definition of category, per se? When you say product category, what can come under that? For instance, can you use personal care products as a category, as a product category? Because, again, the commenter, I think, from NRGC, who talks about integration and classes, I think that's going to be critical. So if there is, for instance, a chemical, like a phthalate or something, that's in several personal care products, can you have as a product category something as broad as personal care, and then identify within that category certain specific, products, a lotion or a lipstick or nail polish or whatever, because that would be important. I'm sorry.
Yes, Amanda, would you mind answering that question, please?
Which is in the work plan, the product categories
can be quite broad.
And one of our question number five, specifically goes to that issue,
okay,
which is how broad or narrow does it make sense to make these categories to number one, give signals marketplace
right.
that we are looking at having given product categories, and we don't want to make it so broad that that's meaningless. We've got market signals, so and we don't want to make it so narrow that we can't actually capture for the product that was, might have a relevant impact.
Right.
No, that's
accurate. And I also, had additional things. Because I think there is a challenge. Somebody brought up, knowing, I think, Meg, about, or somebody brought up about the need, if you get a result through biomonitoring, you don't know which product it could be. It could be as many as different products. But what we do know is that a certain chemicals of concern are in a number of products within a certain category. So that was the reason for the whole personal care thing. So it seems that it's not as worthwhile to go after one particular item in a broad category for a chemical when you can do multiple hits on that. So that would be, you know, so it's good company to know that the categories can be broad. And I wanted to also talk about the exclusive exposure. And my concern is a little bit different than Meg. I think part of the way exposure, to me, it's use is a surrogate for exposure. So when you say rooted exposure, it doesn't quite get at the use category. Because I'm concerned about how it's used, who uses it, how much they use it, where they use it. And because that gives me a sense of exposure. And it goes beyond inhalation or skin contact. But it does give me some idea as to potential for concern. I know that it's, you know, somebody uses a lot of something, they use it daily, or if it's used inside versus outside, all of those things have to do with it. To me, it's a surrogate for, I mean, you know, use becomes a surrogate for exposure. And exposure is the hardest thing in all of this to assess. We don't have a lot of air monitoring data. We have some biomonitoring data. But we often don't have the exposure information we need. So while we think of exposures, I think expand beyond root and think more, and think, in addition to think of use as being a surrogate for exposure, because that's often all we'll have. And that also gets us into population used by children. I particularly like the nexus between hazard traits and sensitive population, because children and infants and fetuses are a population of great concern, especially for those things that can cross generations. So as much as we can do, I see all of this as iterative, that it's hard to separate. I mean, you've done a great job of pulling out the things that you would think about, but you can't think of one without the other. I think one of the commenters said that. You can't think of a chemical without thinking of exposure or thinking of, you know, and within some of these hazard traits, sometimes I think the other thing to think about is the scientific evidence to support it, because we have a lot of traits, and some of them are emerging traits. But I wouldn't go after epigenetic toxicity and the hazard traits. So I think the department also has to think of things that we can support with science. And, you know, I mean, you don't have to have, we want emerging things, but you also want to be grounded in the science in a way that we can support the rest of the process. So within that, you have to think about all of those things.
Julia, thank you very much. I'm Ken Geiser, Helen, Julie, and Mike. Ken Geiser, Ken, can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Thank you, Art, and thank you for a chance to comment at this point. I would like to suggest another approach, an additional approach, maybe a seventh approach, and I'm going to call it the functional use approach. Anne has alluded to this, and has been, over the last couple of years, a growing discussion amongst several people. Anne's been one of them, Joel Tickner. Cal has been involved. So there's several people that have been thinking about this question, and I think it's appropriate for what we're doing. And let me step back and say how I approach this issue. And that is that, you know, I'm very supportive and very happy with the three candidate chemical product units that we've identified already, or the department has identified. I think they're very good, and I think they're a great way to start. On the other hand, though, I think that they have a risk, which is a risk in the whole way we think about this, that we pick chemical product units that are very independent of each other, and even if we were to change even if we were to stimulate, I should say, because we're not changing something, we're simply stimulating the possibility that industry would look at alternatives and find different safer alternatives. Each one would be an independent thing within a context, and I worry that the program could suffer eventually from a kind of ad hoc feeling of, well, we've done this chemical product, but what is the broader impact that we've had? And down the line, I think one of the things we want to test our selections about is, did we just get a few products with safer chemicals on the market, or did we in some way actually shift the market? And I appreciate what Randy said. We're not in the business of banning chemicals. That's not what the spirit of this is about. We are in the business, though, of stimulating a desire to look for alternatives. Along that line, I think this functional use idea is a useful way to draw up a category of chemicals. When I look at the categories that we have, some of them, I think, are prone to ending up helping us select chemical product units that would be independent of each other and would not have a way to assess whether we have had a broader impact in the long run. And I would definitely say the relative exposure one would be an example. I start from the assumption that many, many chemicals have hazardous endpoints, and so many of them would be potential for any of these approaches. And if you're looking at loops of exposure, what would you be doing? You would be seeing if you have closed, you've had impact on loops of exposure. The solving of one chemical product would not affect other chemical products, and therefore you couldn't evaluate in the end whether you had an effect. If you look at sort of the endpoint approach, I think you could possibly see a way of sort of saying, well, say you continue to focus on reproductive hazards or something like that. Eventually, you ought to be able to stand back and say, have we improved, looked at the many alternatives that could be there around reproductive hazards or not? But I think this functional use thing probably has the most power. What does functional use mean? It would mean looking at those chemicals that perform similar functions and something like bonding, all those substances that are involved in bonding surfaces together, or all those substances that are involved in disinfecting surfaces, or a common one that we've all thought about, which is those substances that either retard or prevent flames. By narrowing the field of chemicals down, and therefore the field of products down, I think we could see whether we have an impact over time as to whether we're changing a market by really creating a much more innovative market that is seeking alternatives, not simply for one product chemical, but for a group of product chemicals. And so I think if we did a functional use approach, as I'm thinking about it, I think it would broaden the impact. I think it would provide an environment in which various firms could learn from each other and could be more efficient, because maybe you wouldn't always have to do the same analysis, or the similar analysis could be used collectively. I think it also could improve innovation because it might suggest that there are changes in functions that could indeed produce the environment for safer substitutes. And I think that it could, in the alternative assessment, that it could open up options, because it might lead you to many non-chemical options as well as chemical options for substituting or finding alternatives simply by focusing on the functions themselves. And I know that Anne and Cal and others can probably speak more about this, but I want to just introduce that as another approach to the list of approaches. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Just another reminder for the panel members to identify themselves to help people that are on the telephone. I have Helen.
I'm sorry, can't hear at all.
No, we can't hear at all.
Noticing as I was reading these approaches that there doesn't really seem to be a consideration for the magnitude or severity of the impact, and since the regs actually require that there be significant or widespread adverse impact, I just kind of wanted to raise that issue. And I know we're not going for necessarily the biggest impact, that's, you know, not necessarily part of what we're doing, but we do still want it to be real, real impact, to focus on things that we can think of a tangible improvement. And I mean, to Meg's point of wanting evidence, I think is very important. So I'd like to suggest that whatever methods that you're going to be using, that you incorporate some sort of reality check, some sort of supporting data, and to try to consider that magnitude, especially in the priority vision.
Helen, thank you very much. Now we're going to switch locations to Sacramento. That's Julie and Mike. Julie?
Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to echo and reinforce, I guess, some of the comments made on approach two in terms of route of exposure approach, and the statement as it's written to is that it will directly expose consumers to candidate chemicals in normal use. And in many stages of the life cycle, as others have mentioned, but especially for engineered systems, engineered products that contain chemicals of concern, they're not a chemical of concern during the use phase, but they are definitely chemicals of concern during the raw material extraction, processing, and end-of-life stages. So I would suggest a rewording of that that approach to be more inclusive of all of those life stages, since they are particularly important in some of the complex materials and complex engineered systems that exist and consumers use extensively. So, thank you.
Julie, thank you. Mike?
Thank you. This is Mike Carajal. First, I would like to amend my previous comment, as the gentleman from Dow said. I did misspeak on just using the word removal. That is certainly one option with chemicals, but the power of this regulation is what I should have said was be assessed, because I think what really makes this work is an alternative assessment can come up with the there is nothing safe, there's nothing better. So you do have that whole gamut. So I apologize. And I certainly didn't mean to imply that Ann or Julia were stating removal either. So I just wanted to be clear on that. Regarding the methods here, the one that stands out to me is the nomination process approach, as different than the others. I think it is a key portion that needs to be included. I think public comments, be they formal or informal, do need to be considered as priority products are developed or the plan. What I would worry about is again the workload that the department would undertake if there are a large number of these coming in. You know, how do you comment back? If it's a formal petition, then yeah, there has to be a comment period on it. But if you're just receiving informal ones, do you comment back? Should you comment back? Should you let people know what is all out there that you're considering? And then how much of the in-depth scientific analysis of the other approaches do you undertake with each of those? Because I think that you really have to define the science before you put something on that three-year plan, and the nomination process approach doesn't necessarily mean that there's science behind it. It could be PR or interest or whatever is causing that to be there. So I think it is an absolutely necessary approach to be considered, but one that you have to be very cognizant of the workload that could fall behind that.
Mike, thank you very much. So what I'm going to do now is to rotate through the remote locations and then come back to Berkeley. Let's go from East Coast to West Coast, starting with Washington, D.C. Bill Carroll?
Thank you, Chair. And I just want to process check. I used the hand tool. Did you see my hand up, or are you simply rotating through the site?
We're checking. Okay.
Well, in any event, let me just align with the chair. I'm sorry, say again, please.
We didn't see your hand raised up.
Did not. Okay, then I won't worry about using it. I have a couple of comments, and some of these will echo some things that have been said, but that's, you know, sort of what happens when you're toward the middle of the pack. One of the things that struck me as I read these, and maybe it displays my lack of depth of thought, but in none of these approaches was there an approach that went to a direct finding of harm. In other words, something that is in fact causing harm at this point might be a good candidate. Now, maybe the reason that I went to that is after years of listening to Kelly talk about copper and brake pads. But from that perspective, I would think that that's one place that you would want to look first. Perhaps number one is meant to get at that in discussing the endpoint screening approach. But I think that echoes a previous comment, perhaps Helen's comment. The second thing, and you would probably expect this from me. I feel very strongly that there has to be at least some evidence of exposure associated with this. If you don't have some at least plausible exposure to talk about, either as a route of exposure or evidence of exposure, recognizing that both of those carry some inexactness to them, but still some exposure, then you wind up simply with something that amounts to number three, which is the chemical prioritization approach, and frankly, I just see that as a hunt for the guilty and not a very scientific approach. So from my perspective, I would look for harm first, and I would look for some evidence of exposure in terms of setting these priorities. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Bill. Let's go to Ohio. Don?
Okay. Thank you, Art. As I read through these five approaches, the two that that I think are important but I would deprioritize are numbers four and six. So looking at number four, the evidence of exposure approach, and just speaking from the environmental perspective, since that's where my strength lies, you know, we can measure single molecules per liter of water almost in the environment. And, you know, there's absolutely no toxicological relevance for most materials at that level. So merely finding a chemical in a matrix provides absolutely no information on harm to the environment. And so if one of the goals at least is to improve the environment, you know, that's just not a very good metric to use. So presence in the environment, it's just not a very sound approach in my mind. I think the evidence of exposure approach should be kept, but should be weighed along with the other five approaches, and should be downweighed to some extent. And then, you know, on the nomination, you know, I also agree with Mike, I think, who said that, you know, this is important, but could be burdensome to DTSC. I think if there is, certainly it should be kept. That's part of the entire process. But more weight should be put on those that have some evidence associated with them as to effect, as opposed to, hey, I just want to nominate this chemical because I think it's bad. We need to have some sort of level of evidence that it has caused some sort of harm to people, human health, or the environment. So I would keep all six. I would deprioritize those and then agree with both Bill and Helen that, you know, we've got to somehow get to magnitude and severity. And I think there are probably some other tools that can be used, but I think that's the next question.
Thank you very much. Let me just let Meredith interject here before going to the State of Washington for Ken Starker's comments.
Yeah, I just got a clarifying question for that last comment, which is when you said number four was a lower priority, were you specifically talking about the environmental monitoring, or what did you also mean that in terms of the biomonitoring and some of the other monitoring approaches?
Well, my expertise is in environmental monitoring. I would think the same type of thinking, though, applies to the other monitoring. So I would think that applies also in the human health area.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's go to Washington State. Ken?
Okay, thank you. Great. Just real briefly, I think as we've been talking, I've been thinking about how we've been implementing our children's Big Product Act legislation here in Washington State, and there might be some tools or ways to leverage some of the work that we're doing in terms of the prioritization of chemicals that have been done already in that process. Some of the data that we're actually receiving now in terms of what we call product tier one data that's starting to be reported by the manufacturers, it does come in by product category, and so perhaps some of those types of approaches could be incorporated. I noticed that you're using a very similar approach in one of the little graphics. And so I'll probably just maybe talk a little bit more about this or, you know, question three, but I just wanted to highlight that might be something to consider.
Great. Thank you very much. Looking at the clock, and the fact that we have four other questions to go, I'm going to let my co-chair, Kelly Moran, ask the last question, or make the last comments of this particular question.
Okay, well, I'll try, and then we can see if we want to do any very quick wrap-ups before our break. What I am hearing in this discussion are a couple of themes. One is that the some discomfort of just thinking about products with perceived high exposures and light. I really want to thank Ken and some of the others about talking about what's our bigger goal here. You know, we're really looking to solve problems, to end health problems, to end environmental problems, and to prevent big new ones through this process. So that theme stuff is really important. And to that end, my suggestion, I think we're kind of going on questions one and two both in a lot of ways here. So like Ken, I want to put something out there, which is I think the department should be thinking about what problems do we want to solve. And you're kind of, that's implicit and kind of threaded throughout here, but I think it should be an explicit goal of this program, because sometimes that leads you to look at a group of products that are associated with a particular human health or environmental problem. I've seen this a lot in my work on water pollution, where I've found, for example, the 303D list is a listing of impaired water bodies. These are water bodies that are polluted by a particular chemical. So we've got the harm evidence right there. And there are dozens of waters impaired for copper and zinc, for example. And if you want to solve that problem, what you have to do is the pollutant source identification study. And that's still fairly new science. That's something I've done a lot of work on, and I'd be happy to talk more about offline. There's a lot of mistakes in the scientific literature about pollutant sources. People just write that the source is what they saw on the shelf in the store and don't really think about it. So this is an area that needs some work. But usually it winds up not being one product is the source of everything. Pesticides are the only example where that's true. Everywhere else it's a bunch of different products. And so you might want to be tackling the multiple sources of copper or the multiple sources of zinc or the multiple sources of lead or for human health protection, those kinds of things. And recognizing, of course, that some are products and some might not be products in some situations. Obviously the product sources, and ask the question, with tackling a group of products, with pollutant on it, makes a difference. So that would be my suggestion for a different approach as to how to proceed on this. In just a couple of other more small thoughts, for exposure considerations, I would urge thinking about environmental dispersal as an exposure consideration. At one point in the draft of the reg, somebody had mentioned wear products, you know, like the brake pads and tires kinds of things. But really what I'm thinking about is a lot of people, when they're thinking about exposure, they're, as we mentioned, thinking about personal care products. These are something all over our skin or things that are vaporized in the air that we breathe. immediately. When you go into the outdoor environment, you put on a different hat. I am always staring at what's in the roofs and walls of buildings, so not only what wears off, but what has to be refreshed all the time. So that paint keeps up coming out of paint has to be refreshed, the roofing has to be replaced. All those kinds of things that wear off into the outdoor environment in various ways are at high exposure for certain environments. So that's just something to think about. A number of single-use products, similarly, it's used, it's blown away, and so forth. There's a big waste stream issue associated with that. So those are just some particular thoughts related to that. And I think that it is important to think about more than, here is all of these really group into two things. One is a group of things associated with hazard, and the other one's associated with exposure. And so I think Ken's and my comments and a few of the other comments about harm are really saying there should be this third view about actually tackling real problems out there. And let's pick one off and do a group of products for that, and then we can pick off some other problems too. So, and we'll come back and talk. I've actually got some examples of that when we come to talk about the product question. So, to my coach, I suggest just the opportunity for very brief follow-up in like only a minute or so, and then maybe we take a break.
So, I have a meeting with Juliet before the break.
Yeah. Thanks very much, and I will be brief. I just wanted to say that I've kind of heard three different approaches come out to sort of meaningful groupings, and they've come out from a variety of speakers. One is the issue of addressing chemical classes, which the EPA has started taking on among many other groups. The National Academies have done this, like with phthalates. There are lots of examples that we can help you come up with about some of the meaningful approaches to grouping chemicals together. So that's the chemical class of the approach to sort of meaningful grouping. The second one that we heard is the functional use approach, and I want to offer just very briefly, and I could talk about it at more length any other time, but that's the approach that we've taken in a course, a graduate course that we've been teaching for a few years at Cal. It's been really successful that we take on, an interdisciplinary group takes on a challenge from industry addressing functional use, and we've been doing it with the Biomimicry Institute the last couple of years. So, for example, we had a project working with Levi's, and our functional use in question was cross-linking. And that approached a couple of target chemicals that Levi's wanted to eliminate from their supply chain, which were diisocyanates and formaldehyde. And their shared purpose in different fabric applications was cross-linking, and we looked at biology for how does biology cross-link, how does nature cross-link, and that was the starting place for the students to investigate alternatives. So I think it's not only a very successful way of identifying multiple sort of products within a problem that CTFD is trying to address, but it's also a great way that points toward alternatives and sort of innovative approaches. And the third way that I heard of meaningful groupings is this one that Kelly named, which is, you know, if you're looking at, say, an environmental contaminant, to look for multiple sources. So I just wanted to sort of recap that because I heard three, I think, very useful ways of providing some meaningful groupings of target chemicals or target products or target, you know, health endpoints.
That was excellent. Thank you very much, Meg. Julia?
Okay, I just want to comment briefly. This is Julia Quinn. On the distinction between potential for harm and real harm, because for many of these chemicals, we do not and will not have evidence of harm. And the whole point here is to accent hazard as opposed to risk. We're not dealing with risk here. We're dealing with hazard. And so because I don't want us to think that we have to have evidence that a chemical causes a certain endpoint. We won't have it for cancer. We won't have it for any one of the number of the health endpoints that we are focusing on in terms of trying to get alternatives. And maybe that's not what people meant. You know, evidence of some chemicals having caused harm is one thing, but we have a number of emerging chemicals, and we don't have even adequate data for those. So to think that we're going to have evidence that these chemicals actually have already caused harm in people is not going to be, we're not going to have that evidence.
The other thing I think for us to think about too, and it isn't a category, but what other things are going on in the state in terms of chemicals? What other programs we have? We have a robust program in CARB of, you know, trying to reduce smog, you know, Clean Air Act. So think about some of the nexuses. We have a biomonitoring program. We have an environmental health tracking program. And all of these things are focused in some way on the same kinds of accomplishments we want through this. We want some evidence that we've moved forward and eliminated harm from chemical exposures. So I think it's very good to think about how we can, you know, be a part of a larger movement with this program, because in this green chemistry program, we have an opportunity to fill in a lot of gaps from other regulations that, you know, don't address it as comprehensively, certainly in terms of alternatives that we're doing here. So I think that would be important.
Great. Thank you very much, Julia. Wow, what an exciting start to our webinar and discussion. I have about 10 minutes to 11, so let's take a 10-minute break and reconvene at 11 o'clock Pacific, which is 2 o'clock the East Coast.
Please stand by. The conference will resume momentarily. Please stand by. The conference will resume momentarily.
Hey, I'm on a break at the moment. For 2 hours.
Please stand by. The conference will begin momentarily. Please stand by. The conference will begin momentarily.
Corey, this is Art. We're back. You all set in Sacramento?
All right, ready. We're assembling.
Okay.
Give us a few minutes.
Okay.
Not very many.
No.
One.
Okay. We're all back. Radhika's here.
All right. That sounds good. So let's continue on with our panel discussion on approaches to product category identification for the 3-year priority product work plan. The second question on the agenda is, are there other product category screening approaches the panel thinks we should be considering? And if so, what is the basis for the recommendations? And as you know, we've already started going into this a little bit during the first question. So let's continue with our discussion. And this time I'm actually going to rotate to our remote locations first so they get an opportunity to share their thoughts and comments. And again, I'll start with the going from East Coast to West Coast and then to the physical locations. So starting with Maine, Ken Geiser, would you like to get us started?
Yeah, this is Ken, and I sort of have, I guess in my initial comments, sort of laid out this functional approach area and idea, and I like the way Meg sort of thought about it, and also what Kelly said. I think while I'm kind of proposing another way to think about it, I think the big question I'm really asking is to test any of these approaches against what are the broader impacts that we can see 5 or 10 years from now because we did this. And, you know, even California only has a limited amount of funding and capacity, and I'm just sort of urging us to take a picture that looks at either classes of chemicals or types of uses or functional uses, I guess, as a way to see it. And I think functional uses just works because it opens up such an amount of engineering possibility on how you could do things differently that would give you a fresh look at the chemicals of concern. I'm not going to say much more about it than that I've spoken on to this point, but that's the spirit of this. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Ken. Next is Washington, D.C. Bill?
I have no comment at this time.
moving westward to Ohio, Don?
Yeah, I kind of alluded to that. Well, I think actually it was mentioned the 303 D list. I think Kelly mentioned it. It's essentially the what are the different stressors that are impacting surface waters in a given state. This, I think the Clean Water Act mandated that states have a 303D list and track those types of impacts. So, I know there are, for at least formulated consumer products, similar types of databases with the Consumer Product Safety Commission. EPA has them if it's an EPA-regulated product. Consumers can call EPA and tell them about the product and the effect. And they can also call the company that produced the product, and that company then has to report either to FDA or EPA, et cetera. So I think there are ways of finding out which products have had impacts on the environment, which chemicals have had an impact on the environment and on humans. And Julia pointed out that we don't want to just limit ourselves to those materials that have been shown to have harm, and I agree with that. But I certainly think that's where we should put a number of our eggs, because I think those are the ones where there's demonstrated adverse impacts as opposed to suggested ones. And those are the ones that, in my mind, should be more highly prioritized.
Don, thank you very much. Moving up to the Pacific Northwest, Washington State, Ken? I'm not hearing a response. Let's move to Arctic. Let's move on to Sacramento. Are there any comments from either Julia? I'm sorry, from Julia or Mike?
No, we don't have any comments.
All right. In that case, let's go back here to Berkeley. I have Helen and Becky. Helen? Oh, and again, please identify yourself.
Just Helen Holder. So on this functional use idea, I think it's actually tied to question five of how broad the topic, how broad each of the categories could be. And the way I kind of say it, there are two kind of natural ways that it goes. You can be chemical focused, which actually gives you lots of applications that you have to look at, or you can be functional use focused and you end up with different chemicals that you need to look at. And so I think it's, the agency needs to think about this, of which direction do you want to manage? Do you want to manage where you're looking at the functional use, but you may have 5 or 10 chemicals that have to be chemicals of concern? What does that do? But maybe you're only looking at those chemicals of concern in that functional use. So you've now bounded off all the other uses. Or do you want to go after the chemical in all of its typical uses, which means that you might have 10 different regs where you have 10 different alternatives and substances there. So you can have 10 regs about 10 different functional use chemicals or 10 different regs on different uses of a single chemical. So I think that there are pros and cons of both of those, but I would say those are probably the two ways to think about that. In practice, in the pilot that we did, our recommendation was actually to narrow, at least for the purposes of defining an individual case of a pairing of a chemical and a product, as narrow as you reasonably can for the purposes of getting an AA done. When we started that pilot, we originally thought we were going to do HVCDD and DECA in the housings of the electronics, and we found that we were really unable to both of those chemicals, even though they are both used in housing, they're used in different enough products that it was very difficult for us to successfully do that. So to give you a little bit more on it. So when we were looking at the housings of like a higher end product like a notebook, there were more materials that were going to become available to us as alternatives. And the requirements were different than, say, the back of a television set. There were different levels of mechanical strength and all sorts of formability things that came into play in HVCDD uses versus the
DAPI uses. So even in that case, which seems like incredibly similar, and we went into it initially thinking that that could fall into a single use, even that was not something we could reconcile easily. So just food for thought, I do think, though, that those are some of the two big classes of ways of managing. Either way, I think you end up with maybe more than one set of regulations around a particular chemical or functional use.
Thank you. I have 30 minutes.
This could be characterized. Oh, this is Becky. You guys can hear? Okay, that would be yes. This could be characterized as a market shift approach, where if you spotted a bunch of manufacturers moving away from one chemical and toward another, it might be useful to make sure that that's a greener alternative rather than a regrettable substitution.
Good. Thank you very much, Becky. Are there any more comments or questions related to the second question? I'm hearing none. Excellent. Let's then go on to the third question. This is where the department invites panel members to make specific nominations or recommendations about product categories. And if a product category is nominated, the department is interested in the reason behind the nomination. Are there consumer products or product categories that are known to have strong linkages to particular endpoints? Are there lines of evidence that are particularly compelling? So give that some thought, and let's get started. And this time, let's start with our panel members here in Berkeley. I have Becky and Kelly. Becky?
Hey, so I just learned about this one from the flame retardants meeting in Indianapolis. One idea would be triphenylphosphate in nail polishes. So this is one of those situations where we're seeing this product as the chemical as a substitute for DEHP, diethylphosphate phthalate. Now, I'm going to talk about triphenylphosphate because it's really potent when we're talking about aquatic toxicity. It has a very low PMEC or predictable effect concentration. And I'm just monitoring on it now, but thinking about it more as a flame retardant, we do see it in San Francisco Bay. So I've heard this from the environmental end of things, but at this conference, I learned that we also are seeing this in people and that women tend to have higher levels than men, which means that maybe exposure isn't our typical flame retardant use that we have thought about. This is also used in flame retardant foam and other products. Maybe it's something like personal care products. And it turns out this chemical is used in high percentages of nail polishes, so people are thinking that maybe that's one source of human exposure. There is a growing evidence in some human toxicity concerns, although maybe we don't have such a distinct toxicity threshold like we do with the aquatic person.
Mm-hmm.
For now, I'll let other people get some words in.
Thank you. I have Kelly.
Yeah, I've got several to throw out here, partly to as examples and partly to walk through the logic here because I know the department was interested in that. One is that my colleagues in the wastewater community have continually been raising triclosan in non-medical products. So their interest is not in places where it's necessary, but they've been asking the question, is it necessary in consumer products? The one that they've been focusing on the most is hand soaps and other products that are washed down the drain. I don't know enough about the market to know if that's a major use of non-pesticidal triclosan. But it seems a likely one, but I don't know. I don't need scientific information on that. What I have just found, actually, just this week in the American Chemical Society Chemical and Engineering News has a nice news article kind of summarizing various data and indications of hazards to humans and the environment. And just published online in Environmental Science and Technology is a paper that documents some
changes in wastewater treatment process bacteria, particularly in the digestion process associated with levels of tryptophan that occur in some sewage treatment plants. This is the higher end of concentration levels. But that's very disturbing. It actually reduces the methane productivity at those levels, and that affects the, you know, the whole process is changing because of this one chemical and one set of process. So that's some of the logic that I would bring to the initial part of that, but I know that a lot more work would need to be done to make a decision. Another category is lead-containing products, and again, I'm thinking about ones where there's human exposure. I know there's just been a huge set of discussions around lead in solder and lead in various kinds of equipment. And I'm a lot, and whether that's necessary or not has been a lot of folks arguing it's necessary. There's a lot of other uses of lead out there, and I think lead has been very well documented to harm humans. I mean, just find the evidence of about IQ reductions to be just incredibly compelling, not alone. Yet it continues to appear in garden hoses, in Christmas lights, in ceramics. My parents gave me cute little Christmas logo cups that had the Prop 65 one contains lead. I mean, I can't get past how many products still have lead in them. I mean, this seems like just such a no-brainer. And this, again, I don't know what the biggest exposures are, but I do know that there's some classes of products like Christmas lights where you can't find a box without a Prop 65 warning on it. And you just kind of wonder, why is this necessary? So that would be one where I'd probably be thinking about trying to pick off some different kinds of products to get the market to make that change for real. A third one that has come out a lot in the stormwater community is zinc in tires. And this is an interesting one in that it's different than the other ones in that zinc has a necessary function, at least as rubber vulcanization is typically done. Zinc is the catalyst for the vulcanization, and so it's considered to be required unless you have a different way of vulcanizing rubber. But the question that they've been asking is the concentration that's currently used in tires necessary? And so this is one that there are data that are showing that zinc in tires is about half the zinc in urban runoff. There are some 80-plus water bodies in California, all in urban areas listed as impaired by zinc. It's a pretty compelling case that it's a major source. What the question here is, does the regulatory program have the capacity to address the question when you're saying how much? Rather than not at all. So is it necessary to use this concentration? Would have to probably solve the water pollution problem. The fourth one is also a weird one. It's PCBs and pigments. And there are still PCBs in various consumer products today. One of the ways they've been showing up is in pigments. It's like yellow and green pigments. And they're used in paints and inks. They've been found in boxes, like Eggo boxes. They're being discharged from paper recycling facilities and causing some compliance problems associated with that, with TMDL compliance. There are different and new PCBs, so there's some questions about whether this particular group of PCBs, what are its implications as compared to some of the historic R-Core associated PCBs. This one is particularly what motivates me to bring it up is the fact that we have so many decades of data of harm from PCBs. They're very bioaccumulative, and they're associated with hundreds and hundreds of 303D listings, and they're causing the requirement to reduce them and comply is a big issue. And so it's threatening. It has all kinds of ways through the chain, and there's so many outdoor uses of these products as well as discharges. So that's probably it.
Gary, thank you very much. Let me just ask you a short follow-up question. Given the fact that, you know, you pointed out that lead is found widely in a number of consumer products, so what product category would you nominate for that particular to try to control that particular situation?
See, that's the place where I don't have the market information, and that's the exposure information. So that's really the problem. But I have to say that I think that this is the kind of thing that I think the legislature thought that the department would be tackling is why is lead in all of these different products, and to the extent there's evidence that there are classes of products with lead on them, maybe they all should be listed.
Excellent. Thanks very much. I just got a text message from Sacramento that they changed the webinar tool in terms of doing us for making comments. So I would just rotate to the various remote locations. However, let's finish up in Berkeley. So what I have Julia, Anne, May. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I understand that Ken Salker had a comment related to Kelly's points. Ken?
Oh, thank you. I guess I really like the specific list of items there. One of the things, and we'll provide some comments in writing, but as we started to analyze our data from the Children's Products Act, we're looking at, we're getting chemical information based on the report by function. For example, so she mentioned the colorants and pigments, inks and dyes. We have information about that in the products. Another category is plasticizers, things like that. So I'm thinking that we might be able to mine some of the data that we currently have that might be of assistance to this effort. So I don't have a lot more specifics right now, but I just want to mention that's something that we're looking at and we're thinking about as we begin to mine the data that we do have. For example, we have data that shows the phthalates in the children's products and where it's being reported by product component. I also will mention briefly that we are putting out, Washington State, I should say, is putting out a number of studies on results from toxics in products. We have a report actually today coming out on flame retardants in products. We tested about 125 products. So we'll be making those studies available. We're also doing them on PCBs as well. So those will be released out over the summer. And finally, we do have a products database where all this reported data will be accessible to the public, and it's currently available for testing. If people want to test the use of the products database, it could show, you know, what product we tested, who the manufacturer was, the component level information, that kind of thing. So that might be helpful as well.
Anything else, Ken?
No, thank you.
Great. Thanks very much. So here in Berkeley, I have Julia, Anne, and May. Julia?
Yeah. This is Julia. Yeah, along the lines of the functional use, and I think two things. The functional use, plasticizers as a group, and plasticizers in personal care products. I mean, somebody mentioned triphenyl phosphate in nail polish. You know, what's happening is this move from phthalates to other plasticizers. And I also want to mention that the biomonitoring program is focused, some of these chemicals that are on your list, that are on our exposure side of the regulation of biomonitoring chemicals, triphenyl phosphate, It's on the designated list. It may be even on the priority list. I'm not really sure. But a lot of the emerging chemicals that are taking the place of like bisphenol A and some of the phthalates are being tracked with the biomonitoring program. So that would give us another point of nexus with another state effort to reduce toxics. I'm also interested in and the cosmetics program as well. We have a cosmetics database that's monitoring, you know, chemicals of concern. And a number of these plasticizers and other chemicals, lead, are in cosmetics as well. You know, because our threshold for, and this program is excellent to deal with some of this, because the first question that's asked is, what is the
is this chemical needed? So, you know, that would get us into answering that question if it's considered by the Green River Science, I mean, if it's considered by the DGSC. Also, in terms of chemicals that in this last round, I mean, one of the products we have now is ink strippers. I would like to see some extension of that category to include graffiti removers, because we have N-methylpyrrolidone, which is a developmental toxin, which right now can be a regrettable substitute for paint stripping, you know, can be used in paint stripping right now as a substitute. So I think, and it's used quite commonly in graffiti removers, and it's also regulated by CARB as in terms of methylene chloride use. So I think coming back and getting some of those categories, like adhesive removers and graffiti removers, would complement very well and keep us from heading down the road of regrettable substitutes for the paint stripper, methylene chloride and paint strippers that we've already chosen. And I should say triclosan is another chemical that somebody mentioned, which is also being monitored by the, it's a chemical that's on the list for biomonitoring. And also the biomonitoring program is a source of a lot of toxicity review data that could be used by this program in terms of not recreating the wheel for some of these reviews. So again, if any of these things that we can sort of line up as complementary to other programs, I think it gives us more bang for the buck for this. And there are many others, but I'll just stop there.
Julia, thank you. I have Ann Blake next.
Thank you. This is Ann Blake, and Julia's done a fabulous job talking about nexuses, and I'm doing potential overlaps, but that's with a fair warning and full disclosure. Kelly, I would love to echo a support for triclosan. My challenge has been with that it is regulated in the CIFRA under many uses, at least on the consumer product uses that I'm familiar with, so I would love to explore that further and see if there's a space where there's no, where there's a non-CIFRA regulated use that is contributing to wastewater conservation, wastewater issues. The one that I would add, and this one is also has a potential not-so-positive nexus with FDA, is a substitute for food packaging, BPA, epoxy, and food processing. And this I have both from consumer concerns, which we're probably all well aware of, but also a worker exposure and epidemiology study that came out of Ontario, Canada in the fall of 2012. 1,000 women and 1,000 controls showed 5 times the rate of premenopausal breast cancer in 2 occupations, automotive plastics and food processing. And that's one that I would like to pursue further. The challenge being is that we're seeing some of the substitutes that are coming have been submitted to FDA as potential alternatives for food contact services, include methacrylate, styrene, other things that were just set off my regrettable substitution slide. So that's one. Obviously, the issue is that FDA regulates the food contact surface piece, but if we can help with the assessing of substitutes, that would be something that I think we could provide some input on, some useful input. There's one that's fairly new, but since, and I don't know enough about it, and maybe Ken Darko, this is something that I have learned from Washington State, so if you have more information on this would be helpful. The use of hydrochloric acid in car washing, and I don't know what the functional use is. It sounds like someone knows what that means, huh? Functional use?
It's used in, I think, certain tire.
Tire cleaner?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's one that we'd like to explore, obviously, from both an occupational point of view and from water contamination. And I think that's what I've got for now.
Thank you very much again. I have Nate and then Meredith.
Okay. I just have a brief note. I think exploring, I wanted to echo 2 points. Exploring triclosan is an interesting one in the that's, I think, untapped so far. And also to echo Anne's note about BPA, because I think there's a lot of uses of BPA that are not yet investigated. And, for example, I think EPA and their action plan has deferred largely to FDA because of the statements in that action plan that its primary source of exposure is from food contact materials. And I think that the evidence is still actually out on that. I don't think you can actually say it that definitively. And, for example, some of the sources that we know about are like registered receipts and those have quickly gone to some of the substitutes like UPS. And so there are plenty of uses that may be really significant sources of exposure, both occupationally and to everybody, that are not being sufficiently covered in other approaches. The one I was going to add is fluorinated surfactants. And one of the reasons that I'm interested in fluorinated surfactants is because it's a pretty rich area for substitutes. In one respect, the industry is going largely towards shorter chain fluorinated surfactants because they are less persistent, but there isn't really convincing evidence that those are actually safer substitutes in some respects. They may be less persistent, but I'm not convinced about all their other attributes yet. And it has many, many applications, so there's a potential, the outdoor clothing industry is very actively looking for substitutes, and there are some interesting non-fluorinated substitutes under consideration, like paraffin-based replacements that are potential just as a complete departure from fluorine chemistry. There's all of the indoor applications, which are very high exposure potential, especially for kids, and that consumers have very little choice about, like carpet coatings, furniture coatings, etc. And that, again, is sort of one of the examples I had in the back of my head in my caution about approach number two, is that we don't necessarily think about some of those more invisible sources to our environment. It's not something that I may have ordered to be applied to my couch, but nevertheless, it's in my indoor dust and kids are exposed to. That's all.
Can I ask Meredith next?
It's come up a couple times today, so I thought I would let people know that there will be a discussion of the nexus between the Safer Consumer Products Program and Biomonitoring California. That's scheduled for July 10th, downtown Oakland at the California Endowment Center on Broadway. And I'll be speaking, as well as Claudia Polsky from the AG's office and Chu Quach from the Cancer Prevention Institute of California, and we're really going to dig into this topic of how do we use biomonitoring results and how do we complement the work that they're already doing through the Safe Consumer Products Program to inform our product category and product selection. If anybody has questions, contact me and I'll get you the details.
Hey, I thought I would throw one more clarity product out there. I'm glad to see everyone's interested in triclosan, another antibacterial chemical that is used for in a lot of consumer products that aren't regulated, would be silver or nanosilver in clothing. So that's a pretty well-established acquired toxicity concern, and that's a regulated contaminant, and we definitely know that silver is in a lot of clothing, especially sports clothing. And it washes right out and gets into our pathways and it touches.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So now let me rotate to our remote location. I'm starting with Sacramento. Julie, Mike.
This is Mike. I want to make one quick comment. And maybe it's jumping over to question four, but I'll forget if I don't say it now. With the triclosan, I just wanted to comment that the state of Minnesota has been looking at that as well. So I think the agency would be well served to make some contacts there and see what information they can mine. And that's all I have. Go ahead, Julie, anything?
Okay, good. Let's go back to Washington State. Can, do you have any additional comments?
Just a similar idea that perhaps states could take a look at what's been done and, help do some prioritization so we don't duplicate efforts.
Good. Thank you very much. Shifting to Ohio, Don?
Nothing to add. Thank you.
Washington, D.C., Bill?
I have nothing to add. Thank you.
Maine, Kent Geiser.
Sure. So basically, I'm going to just continue to follow the theme that I'm on here, which is not so much to name a chemical product, but to name the reason, the mid question in this question is, what's the reason for naming that? And to sort of say that, for instance, I think triclosan would be an interesting chemical, but I would start by sort of saying, I think microbials would be, and therefore I would look at others, which triclocarbon and other such things, but to sort of step back and not just focus directly on that substance without seeing the context in which what we're trying to change is microbials or something like that. But I do, maybe some other categories would be textile finishing chemicals, which would obviously pick up the fluorinated compounds and the various chemicals used for durable finishes, which I think are problematic because they are not cross-linked and because they flake off and because there's lots of potential problems there. And a third area that I might think about would be, as I mentioned earlier, bonding, surface bonding chemicals, things that bring things together and lock them together, which would bring up isocyanates and formaldehyde and other substances like that. So I guess same thing, but I would just sort of say it in a way that that sort of explains what we're trying to do. What are we trying to change with these chemicals, chemical product categories? That's it. Thank you.
And thank you very much. I see one more flag here in Berkeley. Meredith?
This is Meredith Williams, and I just wanted to respond to Ken's comment just to say that is within the spirit of the work plan where we are intending to announce categories rather than specific products. And so taking this approach that's a little broader and then giving ourselves a little more time to really look within those categories for what problem we want to solve or where the biggest, the significant impact is, could be addressed systematically.
Meredith, just say thank you. That's very helpful to know, and I applaud that kind of perspective.
Thank you very much. Excellent answer to question number three. Now I'm switching my chair and duties over to my colleague, Kelly Moran, for the fourth and fifth question.
All right. So we have not much time and much topic for discussion here, so I do want to do a quick check-in with Meredith of question four and five. It seems to me that question five is a higher priority, so maybe we should be coming to question four quickly. Is that true?
I think that's a fair statement.
Yeah. Okay. So what I'm going to ask the panelists to do on question four is to prepare yourself to just give a very brief a minute or so intervention if you're going to make a recommendation, and consider following up with an email to staff if you have some specific recommendations. And we'll start here at Berkeley and then work our way across the country. I do want to offer, I understand that DPFD asked if Meg Schwartzman could say a few words about a particular project, and so she gets more than a minute, but I'm going to ask the rest of you to keep it very, very brief so that we have some time to tackle question five. So, Meg, I'll turn it over to you, and then I see Becky and Art.
Okay, thanks very much. I just want to, I've made a couple notes so that I can try to be as brief as possible. What I was asked to describe very briefly is a training project that we did, that UT Berkeley did for DTSC staff in August of 2013 that was meant to work with staff who are not necessarily used to gathering the evidence required to sort of build a dossier, you know, a sort of collection of evidence to support a chemical product combination nomination, to sort of do a brief training about how to assemble that evidence. And so we were trying to offer some guidelines for conducting a thorough literature review, for some suggestions for gathering evidence that meets the regulatory requirements for reliable information. So what we did was we structured, we kind of took what we know about assembling literature reviews and gathering scientific evidence about chemicals and products or chemicals and their health effects or environmental effects and put it within the framework of the regulatory requirements. And so we sort of built a stepwise suggested method
for staff as they're trying to gather the evidence and decide whether a certain chemical product combination has sufficient evidence to merit nomination and to be defensible and meaningful and meet the criteria for reliable evidence. So what we did was just a one-day training that was really kind of just scratching the surface, but that provided some resources to the teams for templates for gathering information that we assembled by the regulatory requirements and suggested resources for the most readily available, reliable information. And we also provided some case studies in which we had assembled information in the way that we felt like would provide the kind of backup that the department needed to be able to put a chemical product combination forward. And I would just say that one of our reflections from that day, which for one thing, the training was a bit short, and staff didn't get to spend quite as much time with the materials as would have been helpful. Also, I think it came at a time in the staff process that wasn't ideal and maybe needs to be revisited as you start looking at the work plan. But one of the things that I think we were struck by was that the greatest potential handicap was the department's lack of access to the primary literature. So that was a real shocker to me coming from the university where I can pull up any journal that the university has a subscription to, which is hundreds, if not thousands, and this evidence is at my fingertips, and those same tools are not available to the department. And that to me seemed like one of the particular things that you could ask the legislature for, is help with that. And where possible, we need to be pointing you toward the resources where that literature is already summarized, right in the biomonitoring assessments of chemicals, both at the California biomonitoring program level, but also at the U.S. EPA biomonitoring program. So where there are opportunities for us to point you to sources of already gathered evidence, that's a really high priority also.
Thanks, Meg. Thanks for keeping it brief. So now everybody else, we'll start with Becky and Art, and then I'll be moving through the other locations from West to East.
Hey, this is Becky. So one source of linkage that could be valuable would be all the information that's on work-related asthma, because that's a very clearly documented health effect, medically documented, and often the workers affected can pinpoint what product or chemical started to trigger those symptoms. Then I also wanted to just be cautious about the word linkage, because I was curious that you can't always make these really clear, super tight connections between products and health effects.
So I've got Art and Julia, and then we'll go to Sacramento.
Art Fong. One of the resources that I used that's very consistent with the template that Meg has just mentioned in terms of selecting chemical product combinations are the European Commission comprehensive risk assessment reports that they do to support the various EU regulatory programs such as ROS and REACH. So within these comprehensive European Commission comprehensive risk assessment reports on different chemicals are sections on different exposure situations, so they have occupational exposure and consumer exposure. And they calculate margins of safety for the different exposure and use scenarios. So if you were to go into those reports, then you would get a really good idea of the relative risk, you know, high or low, for different combinations of chemicals and products, or chemical and consumer product use situations. So that's a really useful resource that I rely on.
All right, Julia?
Two things. I still use the household products database, which I think has categories of consumer products, which is useful. Some of the MSM, and also I just want to emphasize you can't get around material safety data sheets without safety data sheets, which now with the new Hazard Communication Standard, you're obligated to list the percentages of all of the chemicals in the product. So I would say whatever you see on a consumer product, wait to see the data sheet before making a judgment as to what's in it. I've done a lot of reviews for Nail Salon Collaborative on nail polishes, and there's no getting around with the, and Anne has done that as well.
for doing the SCSs and linking it to a PubMed search or a search of the literature. No way to short-circuit it in terms of finding out what's
important. Thank you. As we move to Sacramento, I'll note on support for our suggestion of looking internationally. I've used a lot of new resources. The Netherlands has tremendous water resources. So Sacramento, Mike or Julie, you have any comments?
No, neither of us have a comment.
All right. Ken Starker in Washington?
Yes, well, briefly, in addition to what I mentioned earlier about the products testing database as a resource, I'm also thinking that there may be product testing methods that can be shared. For example, when we developed the Better Brakes program, we actually had to come up with a method to actually test the brake pads, and so we work with professional organizations to develop those test methods, and that may be something that we need to do some work on as we do more product testing in the future. But a lot of the standards we use currently now are based on EPA standards.
And a great example of collaboration between Washington and California, that brake test method. On to Ohio. Don, do you have any comments?
Yeah, I previously mentioned them, but let me mention them again. So EPA and FDA and the CPSE track consumer exposures and incidences of adverse effects. And those databases can be accessed. Thanks.
Thanks. Bill Carroll, are you still there in Washington?
I am, and I don't have a comment at the time.
All right. And Ken, you're our last one in, out there in the East.
Yep, but many of the ones that have been mentioned already. The only thing I would add is I've used the Chemical Economics Handbook for years. I still think it's a tremendous database. Maybe not as strong on the product link, although I've been able to make a lot of connections to it on products.
Wonderful. Thank you guys for being so efficient and making such great suggestions. And just to emphasize, if you weren't able to say something or think of something, I'm sure the department staff would be thrilled if you would email them your favorite resources. So let's move on to the fifth question, which is about requesting the panel's insights on the issue of how broad or specific the work plan product categories should be. And there's a tension between breadth and narrowness that they really want us to explore and advise them on. So there's a figure in the memo that you all should have seen, and so if there are, I'm hoping that we can just move into the discussion given the brevity of the time remaining to us. But if you want to ask a question as part of your remarks, please feel free to do so. And I'd like to try to do this as a single go-round, given the amount of time that we have. We'll see if we need a second round of interventions, we can do that. So again, I think in the interest of time, I'll start here at Berkeley and move around. So if you want to say something, as Anne is our first volunteer, she can do that, and then we'll move geographically again. Maybe I'll start east to west when we get to outside of here.
Thank you, Kelly. I wanted to expand a little bit on the functional use discussion that Ken brought up, and I wanted to say that this is something Joel Tickner at the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production, Jessica Schifano at OSHA, Cal Bayer Anderson at US EPA, and I have worked on along with some other US EPA folks. And there will be a couple of papers coming out soon. First, Joel and Jessica's defining functional use as we mean it, and we're actually going to call it functional substitutions, with the emphasis on what kind of information do you need in order to make an effective substitution, and at what level of detail. And then the work that I've been doing is figuring out precisely the question that I think DTSC is asking here, is what level of detail is it exists. Actually, let me describe what I've been doing, and I'll try to be brief. I've looked at a dozen or more existing functional use categorization systems to see what level of detail they use, and then try to figure out which of those is most appropriate for the kind of work that we're doing. Those were all created for other different kinds of uses, B2B, regulatory, and others. I'm happily we'll talk to DTSC staff more if you want to get into more depth about that. But one of the suggestions I would make is take some of your top maybe choices of chemicals and products and see, just sort of test it out. You know, sort of if you're looking at flame retardants as a functional use category, are you looking at flame retardants in plastics, or are you looking at flame retardants in plastics and wiring cable? You know, where's the, going back to Kelly's framing of what problem are you trying to solve? what level of detail would you find most useful in order to target the problem that you're seeing and target the broadest potential use of alternatives, not just chemical alternatives, but also design alternatives? So I'll leave it at that for now, but I will just volunteer that there's a lot of work here that we would happily share.
Thank you.
Hey, I just wanted to have it both ways, and I wanted to say, oh, we're going to look at hair products like nail polish and lipstick or something. So get both tight signal and a broader one, and don't constrain yourself too much.
And I've got Helen next. If anyone else in Berkeley wants to speak, please put up your flag before Helen. If you're on the phone, it would be helpful if you would hit the *6 to mute yourself. Remembering that you'll need to undo it because we're getting that breathing again. Somebody's ready for the mute to talk.
This is Helen Holder. I think that a lot of the intent of wanting broad categories is very good, and I appreciate the desire to make these big impacts. And as someone who would actually have to do one of these assessments, I have to just say, no, we have to, in order to have a meaningful alternative assessment that a regulated entity can successfully complete, it needs to be narrow enough that we can answer the question. So the functional use of flame retardants is too big. I'll say that right now, too big. There's no way that any entity today could actually do that alternative assessment and give you something useful. What we need to do is make it as narrow enough to do an assessment. And then if you have multiple types, that would be fine. You know, I think that, if you want to look at flame retardants in housing or flame retardants, narrow it down so that it's actually something that an entity could be successful at. That, I think, is a very good goal to have.
So, Meredith, I'd like to comment, and then Helen, you may want to come back and react to this.
Yeah. So I want to make a distinction between what we're putting in the work plan and what we select as a priority product. And what goes into the work plan are these categories. We are allowed, of course, in some very narrow categories that essentially could be construed as priority products. But, again, as we go to regulation, we do need to have that degree of specificity so that somebody could do a meaningful alternative analysis.
I don't want it to be all a fishing trip. We're going to say flame retardancy at the work plan level and then see who's green, right? That's probably not going to give you a good result. I think you need to be more specific than flame retardancy as a function, but it may not necessarily have to go down to more energy, right? So that might be at the work plan level too far, but somewhere between there is probably where you want to be.
Thank you. So now I'm going to the other side, since, as I promised, starting east and moving west. Ken, do you want to weigh in on this and advise the department about how their work plan might define product categories?
Yeah, let me clarify the way I'm thinking about it, Helen. The idea of functional use is relative to the way in which the department establishes the category of chemical products that they'd be looking at, but it would not be necessarily tied down to the actual analysis. There's two different things here. The reason why I'm sort of talking about functional use is a way to think about the broader categories of chemicals that would be on the list that the department could select from, is because I think it just opens up lots of opportunities for thinking about many different changes within a certain area, and then you could actually measure or evaluate later whether you were having that effect. On that basis, then, I would, and here, in fact, the way I would think about this is I would keep the it wouldn't be overly narrow, but I think it's important to be clear about if you do something like functional use or something like that, that you have a very clear statement about what it is that the category is in order to have an effect on the market, in order for the market to understand that this area is an area that California is going to be asking people to search for safer alternatives in. And if you make that very broad, it will be fairly meaningless, and it will just be lots of people doing lots of things. But if we can keep it narrow and focused, I think it can lead to a kind of drive for innovation in the market beyond what we do in our actual final product category selection. So I would generally keep it modestly narrow.
Thank you, Ken. Bill in Washington, I bet you have something to say about this.
How long have we been working together, Kelly?
Long enough.
Yeah, I kind of do. And what this question inspired in me is a recollection of some of the discussion that we had the last time about lessons learned that the department brought forward, one of which was a desire to engage industry earlier. And also, when you take that and some of the both controversy and colloquy around the selection of spray polyurethane foam as a product, I would like to the department to think about using the work plan as a way of encouraging industries that might be selected or industries that make products that might be selected to bring forward that sort of background information to the department before the actual selection is made, and I'm hoping that in doing that it addresses the needs on both sides. I don't exactly know how granular to tell you to be, but I think it should be granular enough that people who know what chemicals are on the list and know something about the products that they're making and know something about the potential for their products to eventually be selected as priority products, we put two and two together and be able to say, you know, we might be at the point of this, it might be worth engaging the department at this point about this product to give them information before the final choice is made. And I would also make it broad enough such that if even if the department had a particular product in mind, that there would be enough flexibility, not infinite, but enough flexibility to be able to say, you know, that might not be a great choice given what we know now from some of the information that's been brought forward, let's think about this over here instead. We've talked a little bit about how, and Ken, you did as well, about how the department's decision can impact the marketplace, and can. And it's not just some of the things you've seen where competitors take the selection of something as a priority product and attempt to use it for advantage in the marketplace. You ought to reasonably expect that sort of thing is going to happen, and if it was a surprise, I find that kind of naive. But there are other places that you could be impacting the marketplace. First of all, you could be impacting it for people who have already bought this product and use it, particularly if it's been a long use application. I think you want to be very careful about signaling that now you may believe that product may not be safe. For a couple of reasons, not as just for the person who's using it, but also because of the signals it sends, for example, to the plaintiff's bar. So you can cause an awful lot of not just reformulation, substitution, and improvement, but you can also cause a lot of, I will call them unintended consequences, by the premature selection of choices. So let me just summarize, and I realize I've been a little bit long on this. I think you should pick or your work plan signals that are granular enough for industries who are aware and circumspect to pick out that they might be somewhere on the list and be able to bring forward to you information about those products to help in your ultimate selections, but not so granular that you have then sent signals to the marketplace that induce those unintended consequences. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Bill. Moving to, and thank you for the insightful comments. I want to make clear that I wasn't trying to limit everybody to a minute on this one because we still have 10 more, 15 more, but I want to make sure we get through this well enough. So I'm trying to move it along. So moving us along to Ohio, Don, I'm going to give some comments on this too.
Yes, thank you. So I agree with everything Bill just said. The only idea I have is possibly including route of exposure. So rather than just saying, you know, personal care products and, you know, compound X, if you could say personal care products where there's significant exposure via the oral route to compound X or via inhalation or via dermal and inhalation to compound X. to somehow narrow it down so that companies will know their, or product category managers will know they're in scope or out of scope. The broader you make it, the more questions you're going to get and correspondences and comments, and you know that means staff time, effort, and work, but you certainly don't want to miss out on a specific impact or some sort of effect. And the only other comment I have is we talked about functional use and we talked about chemical classes. I would focus on specific chemicals. I think there's room to further understand and evaluate the use of functional classes, functional use, and chemical classes going forward. I think it's a little bit early. I have some serious concerns with that type of approach at this point in time. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. On to Ken in Washington. Do you have any comments?
Just a real quick comment. As we look at products and product categories, we've tended to focus down to the component level. So I think, you know, that's something to consider. If you take, for example, something as simple as a kid's backpack and break that down into various components, you know, we may look at things like canvas with waterproof treatments and things like that, or clips on the ends of things. So I don't know if that's, you know, something that, that's the road that we've gone down in terms of building on the scheme that you have listed down to that brick level. And so I think we're still trying to evaluate, you know, how that's really working. And it is a work in progress, so, you know, we'll have to see.
Thanks, Ken. In Sacramento, Julie and Mike, do either of you have comments, or both of you?
Hi, this is Julie Shannon, and the last few comments just prompted a quick thought and a little bit back to Kelly's comments about the lead-containing products and then Ken's comments about different components. And I think it's important to keep in your frame of reference that products sometimes are subcomponents of something else, and that the ultimate use may be a bigger category, but the subcomponent application or function is also important to consider. And I don't know whether you can frame a product category around the concept of containing a particular substance, such as lead. Coming from a field where in material science we really don't have good guidelines for getting lead out of our engineered products. And so when the questions come up of why is there lead in Christmas lights and why is there lead in alloys that goes in, that go into these subcomponents, if there's a way of defining a product category, and I don't know if this falls within the distinction between chemical product combination or if it needs to be more specific, that it's a lead-containing cosmetic or it's a lead-containing alloy, that I think there is an important feature there of there are certain chemicals that we just don't use ubiquitously, and there needs to be a bit of a signal that maybe we really shouldn't be, and we should be at least looking again to whether or not they're really needed for the overall use or for the subcomponent within a complex product. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie. Mike?
Yeah, just a quick comment. I think most of what I was thinking of has been covered. I think we've done a good job with that. I think the agency, the department needs to be very aware that they're not publishing a list of, oh, here are our priority products for the next 3 years. That it is intending to say, here is the direction we're looking potentially to take in the next 3 years. We might not even cover all these ones that we announced in the plan, but this is the direction we're taking. We want to engage in comments, so you know this is a bad idea, or narrow it down this much, but also be aware that by publishing this, we're going to get the comments that why aren't you including these categories? Why did you miss this one? And so we want to be broad enough that
if there are some that there is a particular need to add, that maybe we can catch that somehow, or it goes in the next 3-year plan. But there are going to be comments on both sides as to why are you including that and why aren't you including that. But other than that, I think everyone did a great job in covering this.
Thank you. And I want to thank everybody for bringing to this and giving a lot of really good information in a really efficient way. There was one part of this question that we didn't cover. So I heard in this question, make them not too big but not too small, so don't pre-list a product category for the most part. I think I heard that pretty clearly. And I heard explore some different routes of getting to things that it might not, you know, be quite generically the global product classification approach may or may not be the best approach for all the different kinds of things that are going on here. But one thing I didn't hear was anyone say there's a better approach than the global product classification approach. And so I just want to throw that out there. And if you're in a remote location, you're welcome to just speak up at this point if you want to respond to this. All right, I'm going to let Ann respond to this, and I'll make that call again.
Thank you, Kelly. As I mentioned earlier, I have looked at, a total of 16 different categorization systems, including the GDSM. And then we just started looking at the level of information used by where we have substitution case studies that have worked, what level of information was used. And I would say I'm not a huge fan of the GDSM. I'm not as familiar with it as perhaps, and I know Washington State has used it to great effect. But successful substitution case studies sitting are just about what Tim has described as the brick level of GDSM. So while this, I won't comment on whether or not this particular system works, that's where I'm seeing, and mind you, this, you know, as a scientist, I have to say the data are still fairly limited. But what I'm seeing is that's the level of information that people are going to for functional substitution.
Thank you, Ann. Does anyone else wish to make a remark on this topic? I'm not hearing anyone, and so now I'll just offer one final last chance at remarks. I'll cycle through all the sites again. Is there anything you wish you would have said today that you didn't say that you want to get in our last 5 minutes? It's Dean Helen here in Berkeley, so we'll start here and then cycle through from west to east.
This is actually not specifically on the product classes, but it does. It was something that came up earlier that maybe was another discussion, is a discussion of what the metrics of success are going to be. And it's sort of tied to this idea of what problem are we trying to solve. So it's a circular sort of thing where it's like, what are you trying to do and how do you know when you've done it? So not for today, obviously, we've got 30 seconds, but for another discussion.
So starting from West East, this is your last chance to say anything before we can close off the discussion. So I'll start in Sacramento. Mike and Julie, do you guys have anything you want to add at this point? It could be on anything.
No comments from Sacramento.
All right. Ken Zarker?
None here.
All right. Donna in Ohio?
I would just like to say go USA.
Yeah. All right. So Carol, you usually have some last words.
I'm with Don.
All right. And Ken, you're our last man.
That left me kind of standing out here kind of alone. I guess the message I was trying to send today is just make sure and think about the broader impact of what we are really trying to do over the long haul, and that's the spirit of my comments.
That's a great place for us to wrap up, because that is, I think, a major theme of the advice the panelists provided today. So at this point, we're going to move into the wrap-up mode, and I want to start off by thanking the panelists. You guys obviously did a lot of thinking and preparation for this meeting. It was particularly reflected in your latter set of comments, because I could see you thought that all through and could just put it right out. And it's really exciting to hear this kind of
it's information insight to the department, but also to recognize the department has been thinking about. I saw the heads nodding. I can see all the staff like we usually can, but I can tell that we're raising a lot of things that they've been thinking about and challenges that they've been finding. And there's as soon as you pull some of the threads we're talking about, they'll run into those same challenges again. So it's in some ways it may simply be reinforcing what folks are thinking about and the importance of it. In our discussion today, in the questions, we provided the department with some suggestions, both big picture and smaller picture, but particularly big picture around the nomination approaches. I didn't hear anyone say throw out any of these approaches. I heard some additional possibilities, and I also heard implicit in the discussion, I was hoping heads are nodding here, a strong feeling says that these approaches fit together. So it's not like it's sequential or you do any one thing, but that there are all these different things may end up leading to the same place, and some will reinforce certain things to help them rise to the top and others fall. And I think that's important too. It's not like you can sequentially go through all of these different things. We heard some product suggestions and some thinking behind those and immediately got to the challenge. I think our question to me was particularly good. Well, how do you pick which one? Well, of course, that's one of the biggest problems the department's facing, and the staff were all making faces when you said that. And that is very much the case. But I know the department wanted to hear not our logic, and I really appreciated the folks elaborated on why they were making the suggestions they did, what data sources, what information background that they were using. We had a number of good suggestions on data sources, and I'm expecting there's way more out there in you guys' world. So please do feel free to pass those on to the department. I'm certainly hopeful that they'll be able to solve that literature thing, and I know it's very helpful to have. Summary, but personally I deal with that challenge of the literature in my work and spend a lot of time at universities collecting scientific papers. And I think that's just critical. And then the categories, we had that big enough but not that too big, small enough but not too small. Gotta be just right. So we're in the three bears and So with that, I guess I'd like to turn over to Meredith and see if there's any final words or anything.
Over in Sacramento, I know that Schwing was taking some notes throughout the discussion. I don't know if there are any parking lot items or anything else you want to put up on screen for consideration. In the meantime, while they're pulling that up, I'll just say that I noticed a lot of scribbling here. I think you gave us a lot of information, and I'm very confident that we captured it.
Meredith?
Yes.
Corey? We didn't capture any action items or parking lot items unless you've got some that we can list now.
No, I think the ones I have are quite internal. I would raise one question. I'm going to throw it out to the whole graph to contemplate, which is the possibility of subcommittee around some of these issues where we have a certain depth of expertise. We have some expertise around functional use, for instance, that came up a couple of times. That obviously could be a topic for a future draft meeting, but it also could be something that we ask our subcommittee to focus on. So I will be coming back to the chairs and asking for some thought around that. In general, we will just be in touch with updates on the work plan as it evolves. There may be some clarifying questions. We may be in touch around that. As far as capturing what we got today, I think we're in great shape. So thank you very much. I do want to take a minute to remind you that the next time we'll get to see you face to face, hopefully all of you, will be October 20th and 21st in Sacramento. The things that went well, we'll keep doing those in terms of arranging the logistics and handling things, but we'll also try and tweak things and make it even more valuable and a good experience for you. So those were my parting thoughts. We keep saying thank you, and we will keep saying thank you because there's a lot to thank you for.
And before I pass it to Art to adjourn, I'll just tell you, I want to let folks know if you have any suggestions for us in running the meeting or working with GTSC on this. We are more than open to them because we want to make use of your time and the quality of the advice that we provide to GTSC the highest possible. So please feel free to call, to email, or either way, because it's so hard, we're all scattered around the country. But Art and I are both looking to do the best we can here for you. So we're looking forward to that feedback. We do debrief with staff, and we do meeting planning with them. So we have a direct opportunity to use that information from you. So, and then also to remind you that because the schedule didn't work out that way, we're not as a group providing advice on the work plan. And as I learned at the assembly hearing that I told you about at the beginning, the work plan and some of these other decisions, they're a mix of science and policy. This panel in its previous version advised the department that it was impossible to pick the perfect product and that it was impossible to tear up and compare apples, oranges, and pears and come up with the highest priority for the whole state. So consequently, the department uses a mix of scientific stuff and public policy in making its decisions, and it's not just stuff, it's real solid science. And that policy decision is not something that we're advising on, but we are advising on science. And if we see things as individuals, even though we won't get together as a group, the legislature really wants us to point those things out to the staff, and you can do that through written comments. You can give them a call if you prefer, but I think that they'll probably want anything that's been identified as a scientific issue to be identified to the staff, and I know that the staff, based on our experience with them, will be happy to receive that kind of information from us, even though we won't meet again until October, and we're going to have a lot of fun on alternative assessment guidance in October. So with that, I'm passing to Art.
With Kelly's excellent wrap-up of our discussion today, I officially adjourn our meeting.
Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time.